All right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on the 18th floor above downtown Chicago. And I'm back. I'm glad to be back. Dan is back. We're happy to be back. I hope everybody had a lovely holiday and some great time with your family. And now we're back here. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke a little bit later on. There have been tons of remakes released recently. We're going to talk about some of those, the best and worst remakes, and the movie reviews. We've got a lot of movie reviews to talk about. We weren't on last week, so we're going to play catch up and review the movies from last week as well as the movies from this week. Jim Leskowski, who's going to be in for Colin Suter, and Eric Childress will join me in just a couple of minutes to talk about that. So everybody, welcome back. We're all happy to be here. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected with us on Facebook at facebook.com/Nick D Show. My great producer, Dan Shagrew. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Nick. You too.
How was your time off?
Very nice.
You had a birthday? You had a Thanksgiving?
All those things. A lot of quality time with the family.
So very cool.
Very nice.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
That's Dan Shagrew. He's here till 5, like we all are. There you go. And in the newsroom is Vic Vaughn. Vic, how was your holiday, sir?
It was just fine. I'm pretty good with family. Loved it.
Yeah.
A lot of laughter.
You know, Dan and I drive in. Dan is kind enough to drive in, pick me up, and we drive in together. And the commute wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. Dan, do you agree?
Yeah, it was.
I mean, it wasn't pleasant.
Right.
But it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. And I'm looking out the window here, and it doesn't even look like. I mean, there's no accumulation downtown. Now, I know that's not the case in like the northern suburbs. People are really not having fun with this.
Yeah, so the thing that we're lucky here downtown is we have the lake right here, and that warm water temperature apparently is making a big difference. We heard our WGN TV meteorologist explain it earlier. Mainly the easterly winds and the warmer water is keeping us from really getting any accumulation at this point downtown.
Yeah, and where I live, it's just kind of slushy. You know what I mean? It's hitting the ground and kind of being slushy. It doesn't seem to be. It's accumulating on cars and stuff.
Yeah, it just kind of melts away
just
on the streets.
Kind of melting away a little bit. Because I don't live, what do I live? Like 5 miles away from the lake? Something like that? Four or 5 miles away from the lake? So I guess that's enough to keep it a little bit, slushier in that area. But I feel for all the people who are getting slammed, man. Because, I mean, wow. And you live down here, Vic, so...
Same thing. Yeah. Well, I live right on the lake, so it was very, very... I almost got blown over walking out of the building.
Bet.
That was the main thing, was getting pelted with whatever that frozen stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a mess out there, and we're going to keep it posted, because it's supposed to go until around mid-morning, correct?
Yeah, 6 a.m. In the western suburbs, they should begin to see the snow taper off around 6 a.m., and then as you get closer to the lake, it'll they're saying it should continue to fall until around 9 a.m.
Okay. All right. So in the morning, we should be over, and then we'll get back to like normal. It'll be a little chilly, but we'll have some sun at least the next day. So, all right, everybody stay safe and stay warm. We'll keep you updated all morning long. Let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, Eric and Jim will join me for the movie reviews. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio, back after a week off. We're here till 5 a.m. Keeping track of the weather for you. That's the big thing right now. The winter storm that's making its way through the area is dropping a lot of snow out there. It's pretty crazy out there, and I think it's going to be a pretty interesting commute this morning during rush hour. So we'll keep you posted on all of that and more. We are going to talk about movie remakes, which, of course, now every other week there's a movie remake. We'll talk about the best ones and the worst ones. And that's all coming up. My dad's going to tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. But right now we are back and we're going to review the movies. It's the Monday morning movie reviews. And we were off last week for Thanksgiving, so we've got 2 weekends worth of movies to review. Lots of stuff happening right now. Eric Childress, who joins me every week, and Jim Leskowski, who's filling in for Colin as he takes a couple of months off. We thank Jim for filling in. They are going to join me to review all the new movies. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. For talk and text, you can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. So let's get the guys in. Here's Eric. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
And Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Nick. Happy to be back.
Yeah, we're all happy to be back here. Stay dry, stay warm, guys, because it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, no kidding.
Pretty crazy out there. So anyway, lots of stuff to talk about. We've got a couple of weeks worth of movies to jump into. So why don't we do that? Let's see. We've got, let's see. Jim, why don't we start out with The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is the Coen Brothers' new movie, which I have not seen because I want to see it on the big screen, and I don't want to watch it on an iPhone. So that
I understand that completely. I think, in fact, it's exclusively playing at the Landmark Century,
right,
if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
But, yeah, this is the latest film from the remarkable team known as the Coen Brothers. May have heard of them before. But there is, you know, just like you mentioned, a surprise here this time around since their new movie is available to view on Netflix. And, of course, they helped to pitch in the funds for this excursion. And, you know, it's like we said, it should be seen on the big screen due to their impeccable track record and, you know, just incredible cinematography. But I will say that it's a collection of six different stories set in the Old West, which is clearly a setting that the Coens feel very passionately about. Each story is separated as chapters in a like cloth-bound book, which we get to see like a hand as it turns the pages, as each chapter of the film is introduced with its title and a nice little color palette teasing an image or an incident to come. The showcase title character actually appears in the first story, which is the most Coens-like of maybe all the films, with its love of music and kind of violent outbursts and offbeat humor. There's a singing cowboy played by Tim Blake Nelson, who seems like he's going to be taking us on quite the journey that definitely has a lot of what you come to love about the Coens. Other tales feature the likes of James Franco as an outlaw bank robber, Neeson as a traveling show producer, Tom Waits as an old prospector, and Zoe Kazan appears as part of a wagon train on the Oregon Trail. And then we also end with the likes of actors like Saul Rubinek and Brendan Gleeson as among some of the passengers on this mysterious stagecoach on the way to a mysterious endpoint. So, yeah, you have a lot of short stories here that are expanded into different lengths, some of which feel a little underdeveloped while others seem like they could be essentially their own feature. And there's no doubt that if you are a Coen Brothers fan, you will likely find a lot to appreciate here. They take certain elements of their last film, Hail Caesar, which was, you know, kind of episodic and even contained like a brief Western homage. And there's also the sensibilities of True Grit and kind of the darker existential flavor of No Country for Old Men. But in a way, it plays like a greatest hits collection. And like a lot of anthology films, there are hits and misses, at least for me. I mean, I would say that half of the stories are really strong. The best chapters in here give you a lot of profound ideas about the nature of existence while also being, you know, entertaining and compelling. You know, half of them I didn't quite respond to as strongly, but again, a lot of moments made me perk up because I'm a true fan of these filmmakers. So there's no denying how funny the first chapter is, especially there's a particular encounter I won't give away with Clancy Brown that's really memorable. And I really felt that Zoe Kazan's story had a lot of genuine emotion, a lot to think about. And what can you say about Carter Burwell, you know, who just might be the best composer out there working today, and the cinematography, like I mentioned, is just impeccable. So like a lot of films this year, I would say, you know, I need to maybe watch it again because, I mean, that's kind of par for the course, too, with the Coen Brothers movies, is that I might warm up to them if I see them a second time now that I know what I'm in for. But this one, in my opinion, is one of the weaker offerings to date. But if you love their style and if you love their human and how, or you love their humor, I should say, you can't go wrong. I'm giving this one a minor recommendation, even if I'm mostly in the middle on it, because, like I said, half of the stories here really shine, and the others I kind of shrugged off.
Okay. All right. So that's The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is playing exclusively at the Landmark Century, but it's also available on Netflix if you want to watch it on Netflix. So there you go. All right. You guys didn't see Fantastic Beasts.
No.
Oh.
No.
All right. Well, I'll take care of that one. These, by the way, we're catching up on the movies that came out last week. These are the films that came out last week. This weekend, we'll jump into that in a little bit. But Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald is the sequel of the two Fantastic Beasts. It's set in J.K. Rowling's Wizarding World. She wrote the screenplay. David Yates, who has directed, how many of these?
Since the fourth one, right?
No,
the fifth one.
Yeah, the fifth one. I think it's five.
Yeah. Mike Newell did the fourth one.
And so David Yates has become the sort of the go-to director for these movies. This one, it's Eddie Redmayne is back as the character from the first Fantastic Beasts. He's Newt, and he's got a sidekick, they have adventures together, and he's obviously, you know, he's a wizard, and he has control over these incredible beasts, and Jude Law plays a young Professor Dumbledore in the movie, reaches out to Newt to fight off this bad guy, Grindelwald, played by Johnny Depp, who is opening up a war on the Wizarding World. And kind of all hell breaks loose, and creatures are everywhere, and magic is flying everywhere. And that's basically the setup for the movie. It is beautifully photographed. You can see the budget. You can see the budget in every frame of this movie. The special effects are, I mean, there's a CGI effect in almost every shot of this movie. And to the point where it gets a little bit much. And some of the sequences are exciting, and it is well made. It's David Yates. David Yates is a good director, and it's well made, and he knows this world inside and out, and is able to bring the world to life, like to make the feel of the Wizarding World come to life, to make the creatures look good, to make the magic seem exciting, and some of the characters are really a lot of fun. But the thing about this one is that because I thought the first one was pretty good. I liked the first Fantastic Beast. I thought it was fun. This one is much darker than the first one. And also a lot less, there just seems to be a lot less interest in this one. There's not a lot of passion in it. It just kind of, despite all the flashy visuals that are happening and some of the flashy acting. By the way, Johnny Depp is really good in this movie. I know people were complaining about him, but he's actually really, really good. I think it's the best performance in the movie, quite frankly. And also, Jude Law is having a blast playing Dumbledore. He's having a great time playing Dumbledore. So anyway, despite the fact that there's a lot of flashy acting going on and tons of special effects and really cool creatures and all kinds of magic and excitement and stuff, it just kind of lies there. And I don't really understand why I felt like I was when I was watching it, but I was not excited by it. There was no real suspense in it. It's a pleasure to look at, and some of the magical effects and that stuff work really, really well, but there's no emotion. I was not emotionally attached to anything that was happening. It's too long, even though it's shorter than most Harry Potter movies. This also felt long because I just was not invested in the character or any of the emotions going on. And I just had fun looking at it, like it's a really fun movie to look at, and the effects are cool and everything. And again, Depp I think is terrific in it. I can't recommend this one. I was disappointed by it. And we're going to do box office a little bit later, but this is not doing well, Eric.
Not domestically. Worldwide is doing fine.
Okay.
But domestically, it seems like people are not as interested in this one as they have been the previous ones.
Yeah. And it just felt that way. You know what I mean? When I saw it, it wasn't packed. You know, there wasn't a sold out crowd. And everybody in the theater, I think, just kind of felt like, meh. You know,
right?
And that's the feeling that I get, like that everybody has about this movie. And I have not read any raves. Most of the reviews that I've heard or read are very close to how I thought of it, how I felt about it, which is, you know, it just kind of like, all right. So I don't know, but again, I think Depp is great, and I think Jude Law is really having a blast in this. So, but that's all I can say about it. I mean, if you just want to go and look at cool stuff, that's fine. But there's really not a story to grasp onto here. So that's Fantastic Beasts: The Crimes of Grindelwald, or as Jude Law says in the movie, Grindelwald, and he's the only one who says it that way. So, anyway, all right, let's see. Okay, Eric.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about Instant Family.
Okay, well, this film stars Mark Wahlberg and Rose Byrne as a couple whose profession is they kind of, you know, fix up, they buy kind of run-down houses and fix them up, and, you know, basically, you know, they're flipping houses all over all the time. But the thing sort of missing in their life is a family. They, not that they can't have children, but, they, you know, they come across some brochures and stuff and, you know, decide, you know, well, you know, maybe we'll adopt a child. So they go to an adoption service, and it was kind of like almost like a pageantry of people, of kids just all over the place, just, you know, hoping to be adopted. It's like a puppy farm, practically. And they come across a teenage girl played by Isabella Moner, who was in the Sicario sequel. She was the girl that Benicio del Toro was protecting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and she, you know, she's, you know, basically they're told that, you know, like teenagers don't normally get adopted because, you know, they come with their own set of problems. It reminds me of the Defending Your Life joke that, you know, teenagers don't come here because they destroy the Tupas. and but they, you know, they kind of like her spunk, they like her spirit, and decide that, you know, like, what the hell, no one else is adopting these, you know, these older kids, why don't we take a shot at fostering one of them? Deal is that her that she comes as a package deal, that the adoption service does not like to split up brothers and sisters if they can help it, and she has two younger siblings, a younger brother who's very kind of a, you know, kind of an emotional wreck, very, very sensitive, and another younger sister. And, you know, they take them on, and it seems like it's all going to be, you know, roses and rainbows and everything. But, you know, there are issues. There's backstories. It's not all as simplified as they might seem. And so we have this kind of what seems to be sort of an atypical story about, you know, it's kind of a mismatched parenting, you know, coming to terms with how to be a parent.
Okay. All right. Hang on, so, Eric. Hang on.
Yeah.
All right. And then we'll get your thoughts on it after we break for the news. That's Eric Childress, and he's talking about the new Mark Wahlberg, Rose Byrne's comedy, Instant Family. So he told us what it's about. After the news, he'll give us his review. And we've got more reviews of last week's film releases and all the new movies that came out this weekend. And we'll do box office as well. That's all coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Glad to be back after taking the Thanksgiving week off, and we are here. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We are keeping an eye on the weather. That seems to be the main story. The area is getting pummeled by a winter storm. There's blizzard warnings out there, and just be safe. If you don't need to go out, don't go out. That's common sense. And just take it easy. But we'll keep you posted on what's happening weather-wise. We're going to talk about remakes a little bit later on in the show, too. But right now, we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're here till 5, and we're talking movies. Jim Laskowski, filling in for Colin Suter and Eric Childress, are with me. And it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Since we weren't on last week, we're playing catch-up and reviewing the movies that came out last weekend. Plus, we'll review all the new movies that came out this weekend. Now, before we broke for the news, Eric was telling us about the plot for Instant Family, which is this new comedy with Mark Wahlberg and Rose Byrne. And let's get Eric back here. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you much.
All right. All right, Eric, what did you think?
Well, you know, movies like this, you know, almost seem to be advertised with the term feel good placed somewhere on the poster. It's just, you know, you kind of expect a certain amount of manipulation when you go into a movie like this. And sometimes that can be fine, and sometimes it can be incredibly grating. The thing about this movie that is really kind of unique is that it appears throughout its entire running time that it's just at war with itself about exactly what it wants to be. This is a movie that, you know, from the, like, the very opening frames when we start to get into the adoption stuff, it almost seems to be guilting the audience into not being as good as the Wahlberg and Byrne characters for doing this. They even have other, you know, parents in the adoption agency. You know, there's this whole thing where we get to meet all the potential foster parents, and some of them are giving like really heartfelt stories. Others are used as punchlines and jokes, including a comedian played by Eliza something, who's used as a real kind of uncomfortable racial joke. She just wants to adopt a black kid because she saw The Blind Side.
Oh.
She wants to adopt an athlete. Okay. So you have these really kind of uncomfortable moments, and even the two adoption agency supervisors, who are played by Octavia Spencer and Tig Notaro, even they constantly, their dialogue is like sometimes like harsh truth and funny, one-liner, and is just constantly at war with itself, and the audience is entirely being jerked around throughout this movie, and not the least of which is because, shockingly enough, this movie is based on a true story. And the whole movie, I'm trying to figure out, like, why was this movie worthy of a true story? There are thousands of people who adopt children every day. What was unique about this particular story? And the only thing I could possibly figure out is that there's a scene in the movie where the two of them confront a boy that they think has sent lewd pictures to their new foster daughter.
Yeah, I saw that scene in the trailer.
Yeah, and they confront him, and it's the wrong kid, and right. They get arrested for it. And thinking, well, maybe that's why these people got famous, because of that. Because it's the only thing in the movie that stands out that would suggest that this is separated from all these other stories. I was really kind of shocked at the way that this movie presented itself. And, from scene to scene, it's like, there's a breakthrough, but then there's a setback, and then there's a setback, and then there's a breakthrough. And then are we supposed to be laughing, or are we supposed to be making fun of them? Because the movie does this scene, sometimes within the scenes themselves, and throughout the entire movie, I could not get on board with anything that was going on. It's one of the most frustrating, aggravating times I've had at a movie all year.
Mm. And this is the annual Sean Anders, Mark Wahlberg family comedy.
That's apparently, yeah. And he hasn't made a good one yet, as far as I'm concerned. And they're getting worse. Well, Daddy's Home 2 is worse than this.
Yeah, well.
I'll say that much.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's Instant Family, and it's out right now. Okay. Let's see. Eric, Green Book opened last week?
It opened in like a limited release last week, and then it expanded wider on day before Thanksgiving.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to save that one for later.
Okay.
Even though it opened last week, I just want to save that one for later. All right. Let's see. Let's go back. We got, and Eric, you jump in again and tell us about The Front Runner. This one we've talked about. You saw it at the film festival, and it's Hugh Jackman playing Gary Hart.
Yeah, I saw this at Toronto. We talked about it a little bit. It's the story of Gary Hart in the 1988 race, where he was the Democratic front runner to challenge George H.W. Bush for the presidency. And people who are familiar with politics and history know the story that Gary Hart was eventually found out that he had an affair with a female staffer named Donna Rice, who in the movie is played by Sarah Paxton. And Hugh Jackman plays Gary Hart. The film is directed by Jason Reitman, and the movie, Jason Reitman's kind of going, a lot of people have said this, kind of going for like a Robert Altman kind of feel. It's like he probably watched Tanner 88 a lot before making this movie.
Wow, I haven't heard that in a long time. Reference to Tanner 88, nice.
Yeah, it's the first thing I thought of. But a lot of overlapping dialogue, camera movements, things like that. The screenplay is an absolute mess. It's a movie that, again, funnily enough, kind of like Instant Family, can never decide what it's really trying to say. Is it trying to say that that the press was somehow at fault for knocking down this great candidate? A movie that keeps telling us, Gary Hart would have been, the greatest president, this country has seen in some time, but never really gets around to explaining why he was so great. They just keep telling us, like, he'd be great, But we never really get a sense of his policies or, you know, exactly what, why he would have been set apart from all the other candidates. You know, he, the reason he got caught is because he actually defied the press to actually follow him, and then was shocked when they actually did just that and caught him in these number of lies. You know, and is obviously, you know, we're kind of just starting to get into this period now where they're, you know, see a lot of films that are parallels to what's going on currently in the country, whether it be fictional or real. And obviously, you know, this was one of those big deals. Whereas this, you know, should the, you know, should something like this disqualify a candidate? And the movie can never really quite decide what the, you know, exactly what, you know, what the deal is, you know, whether it's demeaning the press or it's not really demeaning Gary Hart. Some of the stuff involving the press is clearly is the weakest stuff in the movie. I mean, there's actually scenes within the Washington Post and with Alfred Molina playing Ben Bradley Jr., and those scenes are so cliched. Some of the acting is really poor. One of the actors who sort of is the guy that is dared, or he asked the big question at the big press conference about whether or not Gary Hart ever committed adultery. He's really bad in the film, and it just it never really finds a footing, and it's boring on top of that. It never crackles with, you know, any kind of wit. Hugh Jackman just gets to kind of scowl throughout the entire movie and yell at people for, you know, reporting the truth. So it was a real disappointment. I was hoping that this was going to be a movie that, you know, tried to, you know, make some sense of that period, but it doesn't really. It kind of, you know, goes right down the middle with it, and you don't really know where you end up on the side of this debate by the end of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for people who, you know, don't remember, I mean, it was 30 years ago, but, man, it was a big mm-hmm. deal. It was a big deal.
Yeah.
It was a big story, and I remember following it as it went along, because I liked Gary Hart a lot, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to have my vote. So, But as soon as I heard about this, I don't know why I find it really weird that Hugh Jackman was cast. I don't know why I find that weird. But every time I look at the scenes from the movie, or I'm like, well, I don't, why did they cast Hugh Jackman? And nothing against Hugh Jackman, because I love Hugh Jackman.
Right.
But I just don't know. I don't know. I mean, he just doesn't seem right for the part at all. You know, having you know, like, I still remember all the incidents and everything that happened. When I heard it was when he was going to play Gary Hart, I was like, wow, that's not the guy I would have gone to.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the story and following the story along. I don't remember all of the video and sound bites regarding to it. So I don't know if Gary Hart was quite as forceful as Hugh Jackman is during those real crucial moments in this film. But yeah, I mean, he's also, you know, a lot more handsome than Gary Hart was.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's a real disappointment, because there are a lot of really interesting things that can be said and draw parallel. I mean, whether or not you want to draw that parallel to the current situation or even up to the next administration, for that matter.
Yeah.
I mean, there are all kinds of things you could say, and this movie says none of it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the other thing that's disappointing about it is, you know, Jason Reitman made some good movies, but I think that when you reviewed this from Toronto, you pointed out that his really good movies are written by great screenwriters.
That's right.
And most of them being Diablo Cody.
Right.
It's kind of disappointing on that level, but also there's a lot of great people in this movie. Like, the cast is pretty phenomenal.
Vera Farmiga's Wasted.
Yeah.
As his wife in the movie.
Yeah.
Ari Grainer, who plays the ultra-feminist reporter at the Washington Post, is given nothing but cliches to mutter. Alfred Molina as Ben Bradley, I think, is wasted. All the scenes of The Post, I think, are just like, well, we just had a really good movie about The Post, 11 months ago.
And a great movie about the Post.
Yeah.
So. All right. Well, anyway, that's disappointing. That's The Front Runner. It's out now. And it's about the Gary Hart's presidential campaign in 1988. Okay, guys, hang on, all right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to take a break. Eric and Jim are with us. When we come back, we got more movies to review. One more from last week, and then we'll jump into the current releases. So More movie reviews coming up right after this on 720 WGN. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We are keeping an eye on the weather and give you any updates that we have, and keeping track of the storm that's basically bashing Chicago, the Chicagoland area, especially the northern Illinois and lower Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin areas. So we're going to keep an eye on that, tracking that storm as it makes its way through. So that's all coming up. We're also going to talk about remakes. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to call in at some point. And there you go. We are talking about the movies. It's the Monday morning movie reviews. So that's what's coming up. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. Let's get back to the reviews here. And we're still catching up. We were off last week for Thanksgiving. So we're still catching up on some of the movies that came out last week. Here's Eric Childress. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Jim, tell us about Widows.
So this is the fourth film from filmmaker Steve McQueen, who previously gave us Hunger, Shame, and 12 Years a Slave. This time he sets his sights on a genre heist thriller that takes place in politically corrupt Chicago with a rather memorable cast, to say the least. It starts with a botched robbery job that has gone bad, and Harry Rawlings, played by Liam Neeson, and his crew are essentially dead and left their grieving widows with absolutely nothing. We get a glimpse of the heist gone awry at the very beginning, which starts with a chase and then ends with the explosion of a van. And the $2 million payoff that blew up with the van came from a crime boss named Jamal Manning, played by Brian Tyree Henry. And after losing some much-needed funding for his campaign, he shows up at the home of one of the widows named Veronica, played by the great Viola Davis, and he starts intimidating her, to say the least, throttling her adorable little dog, and he demands that she pay back the money that her husband stole and destroyed. Jamal's right-hand psychopath is played by Daniel Kaluuya, who enjoys stalking and executing people along the way. But there is hope, because in Harry's safe deposit box, there was a journal with plans for a different robbery, along with incriminating pictures of a well-known politician. So ultimately, Veronica decides to enlist the widows of Harry's gang for her own heist to pull off. There's Linda, played by Michelle Rodriguez, whose store has just been dismantled by creditors. Alice, played by Elizabeth Debicki, who might be forced to, unfortunately, market herself to wealthy gentlemen. And in the far background is Amanda, played by Carrie Coon, who seems to be always clutching her brand new baby. So not to mention, they also need a driver for the score, and this ends up being Belle, played by Cynthia Erivo, recently so good in Bad Times at the El Royale. In addition to all these elements, we have the crime boss's opponent in the latest election for alderman, played by Colin Farrell, who is struggling to find his place as a successor in a long line of politicians, including his father, played by Robert Duvall. So how will all these characters kind of come together in the midst of one final score? Well, it does all culminate, and there are even some twists and turns along the way. So despite this being ultimately, when I first saw the trailer, kind of a straightforward story about, you know, some brave, strong-willed women trying to do what their husbands couldn't pull off, there are a lot of pieces to the puzzle, as I described. And for me, this ends up being a very good film that I'm just not quite as high up on as everyone else. I think McQueen does a really great job of setting up the pieces, and we as the audience get to watch it all come together. But for some reason, I wasn't quite as compelled the entire way through. I think the script by McQueen and Gillian Flynn, who, you know, previously gave us Gone Girl, maybe just needed one more rewrite to really stand out. There's something, obviously, I won't give away, that occurs late in the film that I kind of saw coming, and maybe it's just because I've seen one too many Mammoth films or heist films that I felt like I was, you know, kind of steps ahead throughout. But that being said, and I hate to sound like a broken record with many reviews this year, it's a very good movie that I just didn't think quite reached greatness. But at the same time, the performances here are really phenomenal. That's what really grabbed me. Farrell is great. Duvall is having a lot of fun. But there's also a really interesting subplot involving Elizabeth Debicki's character and Lucas Haas as well, who shows up and like, oh, wow, cool. I'm glad to see him back. But, I mean, like, I think Debicki is almost every bit as good as Viola Davis, who, you know, like you often say, Nick, is a national treasure in every way. She just commands the screen. So I can't say I was ever bored. I'm just sort of thinking that my expectations were just very high this time. I'm hoping a rewatch will make me appreciate it just a little bit more than I currently do, but I'm recommending it nonetheless just because of this incredible ensemble, and a daring filmmaker like McQueen just deserves his films to be seen. I wish I could say it's one of the best films of the year like a lot of people are, but I just think it's very good as it stands for me on a first viewing.
Okay. All right. You guys hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric and Jim are going to hang on. When we come back, we'll find out what Eric thought of Widows, and then I'll tell you what I thought of Widows right here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. News is next, and we'll jump back into the Widows talk after the news right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We are here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time, and we're going to be talking about remakes, and we'll be tracking the storm, the winter storm, as it's blazing through our area here, and we'll give you all the updates and information that you need on that, especially as we get closer to your morning drive, which should be an interesting, really interesting morning drive. Mary Vandeveld, by the way, is going to be very busy this morning. That's all I'm going to say. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. We're doing the Monday Morning Movie Reviews right now. And before the break, Jim told us what he thought of Widows, which came out last week. And let's bring the guys back and find out what Eric thought of it, and I'll tell you what I thought of it. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, Eric, what did you think of Widows?
Well, I'm part of the everybody else that Jim was referring to during his review, because I do think this is one of the best movies of the year, and I say that as someone who has not really been that high in the past on Steve McQueen's work. I think it's, you know, kind of okay at best, most of his stuff. But this one, I think everything comes together. Everything just clicks in this thing. This thing kind of moves like dynamite. The performances, you know, are, you know, pretty much second to none all throughout this whole thing on all sides of the equation. And you know, I mean, I know Jim's going to give this movie a second turn, because I know that there are a lot of people that are making, you know, quibbles with the film. I have one that I'll bring up in a moment, but beyond that, you know, I think this thing, it moves like lightning. Yeah, I like the idea that, you know, as a heist movie, you know, I mean, a typical heist movie that was just going for the sort of the pure excitement, the thrill, and, you know, I mean, it almost, I mean, the whole premise of this sounds like kind of a goofball comedy that, you know, we expect, like, you know, like Diane Keaton and Katie Holmes to be in, for God's sakes. But it's not. It takes this premise absolutely serious and gives all of these characters motivations for participating in this, not the least of which is the character played by Elizabeth Debicki, who I think is an absolute breakthrough standout in this movie. You know, she's been in, really been making waves the last couple of years. She's always kind of played a variation on this sort of same role, kind of a you know, an ice queen, femme fatale type of character. But this one, she goes through an entire arc in this movie that is just kind of bewitching to behold. Kind of a, you know, kind of goes from trophy wife to someone who's, taking control of her life, but in a demeaning way, and then ultimately, sort of being the, one of the people that, really makes this thing shine, really kind of finding her own. And, that's, it's a very powerful thing that, this movie, is, advocating for, these women finding their strength, finding their voice. But it's also, it's not just about the heist. This is a movie that is every bit as much about politics. And it's perfect that this thing is set in Chicago, because we all know the stink of politics and corruption that goes through the city from time to time. But it also, does some interesting things with that. The one sort of question I had throughout this entire movie is, how come the Chicago press don't know more about one of the candidates that's running for office by Brian Tyree Henry? It seems like someone might have dug into his past or his present a little bit more, known a little bit more about what he's actually about. But, the Colin Farrell character is not just a one-note guy. He's not just a one-note corrupt politician. All the characters in this movie, are basically kind of living up to the idea that sometimes, morality has to be bent, if you're eventually going to do good things, with not just with your own life, but for other people, and sometimes for society as well. And we see kind of a changing of the guard, if you will, throughout politics in this movie that I think is really fascinating. It's exciting. It's beautifully acted. Like I said, it moves like crazy. I think it ends on one of those really great, perfect notes. Just made me smile ear to ear at the end of it. I love the twists and turns this thing takes. It's one of the movies from Toronto that I could not wait to see again once it was over. I'm looking forward to it very much.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I'm with you on this one, Eric. I think it's one of the best movies of the year as well. And I'm like you, not a huge fan of Steve McQueen. I'm a fan of old Steve McQueen. But not filmmaker Steve McQueen. I think the best movie he's made is Hunger, until this. But I wasn't a big fan of Shame. I wasn't a huge fan of 12 Years a Slave either. But this one is just, this, as you said, man, this just crackles on screen. I love the cross-cutting that he does in the first, 10 minutes of the movie, where he cross-cuts between the personal lives and the heist. I think that was really a wonderful choice to do that. And again, I don't know how many times we can say the cast is so great, and the twists and turns that it takes. I was on board 100%, and I thought there was a real, when you see a typical heist film, maybe not a good heist movie, but you sort of your typical kind of heist movie, there are a lot of stereotypes that are involved in heist movies, and a lot of the characters seem one or two dimensional at best. That's not the case here, because their stories, their personal stories, are just as important and just as compelling as the heist itself. And that's what I think separates this from just, again, average heist movie, because I cared about everybody in this movie, and I found their stories to be really interesting. And I thought that the Colin Farrell subplot was fantastic. And I thought, he's got a couple of scenes with, Robert Duvall that are fantastic. And Duvall's awesome in it. That's Robert Duvall. But I like the relationship between, the three women and then the fourth one who joins them. I thought that was intriguing. And as you mentioned, this is an absolute breakout performance for Elizabeth Debicki, because she's tremendous in it. It's a really, really great performance. It's a layered performance. It's also very funny. She's very funny in the movie. And I think everybody in this just shines. I think it's exciting. Daniel Kaluuya is terrifying in this movie.
Yeah.
Terrifying. There's a scene at Fireside Bowl involving him and Kevin J. O'Connor.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean,
great performance by Kevin J. O'Connor, too,
by the
way.
Of course.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's Kevin J. O'Connor. He's the man.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that they used Fireside. I don't know if you guys...
Yeah.
Yeah, Fireside Bowl. I mean, let me also say that he uses Chicago beautifully in this movie. And some locations, and he uses them on the west and the south side and some other places. And but he uses Chicago really great, and Chicago becomes part of the movie. And that's another reason why I dug it, because it's like, this is definitely a Chicago movie. And of course, adding the adding the politics makes it feel even more like a genuine Chicago movie, not just a movie that was shot here. And it was also fun for me to find people that I knew that were in it. Like, one of my best friends is in it, and I had no idea. I haven't talked to him in a while. Steve Walker, who was in, you know, a bunch of plays with The Factory, and I directed with him. I was in Alive with him. He plays the reporter at the press conference outside, trying to push Colin, and I Colin Farrell. That's Steve Walker, and I recognize he's shot from behind for the first couple of lines, and I recognize immediately when he said "excuse me" and he was trying to get his attention. I was like, "Man, that's Steve Walker," and I got very excited seeing that, and then spotting other people that, you know, you see in a ton of stuff, and it was just fun to watch that. But on the simplest of levels, it's a great heist movie, but it goes beyond that. I think it goes way beyond that. This is and I too love the ending. I thought the ending, it ended on such a fantastic note. And you really liked these characters, and you were interested in them. And I haven't even mentioned Carrie Coon, who has got a small role in it, but a great role. And she's, you know, she represents Chicago in a fantastic way as well. It was nice having, even though her role is small, it was nice to see her, you know, coming out. And Michelle Rodriguez, who I've always really liked, she's really, really good in this movie. And everybody's got a great and interesting backstory. I think it's great. I
should mention, because he'll be upset if I don't. Our good friend Sergio Mims. There are key scenes in the movie that are actually shot like around the corner from his own house.
Oh yeah,
like the whole heist scene, the firebombing of cars and stuff.
Yeah,
like right around the corner from his house.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Pretty cool. Yeah, like there's a sequence where Sergio will probably tell you more about it, but where Colin Farrell takes a drive, I think, from the press conference, and they kind of follow his car.
Yeah, where the camera's outside the car as they're talking.
Yeah. That's Sergio's neighborhood.
That's a great shot. Yeah. That's a really great shot.
And that was a fantastic choice, by the way. Interesting choice to just keep the camera outside of the car while this very intense conversation is going on inside the car. And that's right after the Steve Walker scene, because they get in the car and boom, it's one take. The whole thing is one take. I thought that was a really interesting choice, and I think there's a lot of interesting directorial choices in this movie. A much more interestingly directed movie than he's ever made.
Agreed.
So, yeah, I think it's great. Not a lot of people have seen it. I don't know what the hell is going on, but
no,
you should, because it's great, and it's Widows. So
you saw Ocean's 8. You owe it to yourself to go see Widows.
Yeah, that's true. All right, all right, guys.
Fine. I will watch it again.
All right,
there you go,
guys. Hang on. Okay.
Happy to.
Hold on.
Okay.
All right. There's Eric and Jim. We're going to hang on. We'll come back, and we got the latest movies from this weekend to talk about, and that's right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And yeah, we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're back on a very wintry, stormy Monday morning here. We're keeping a track on that weather situation that's happening. We'll talk more about that a little bit later on. And we got the movie reviews right here, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke a little bit later on in the morning here, as we do every Monday morning. All right, we've got the new movies to talk about right now. Jim Liskowski in for Colin Suter. And Eric Childress are here, and let's get back to the conversation. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back. All right.
Thanks again.
All right, Eric.
Tell us about
Robin Hood.
Okay.
Oh, boy.
Well, this is the 127th version of Robin Hood brought to the big screen. And this one stars Taron Egerton of the Kingsman films as Robin Hood, who is a young man, falls in love with Maid Marian, played by Eve Hewson, also known as Bono's daughter. Just when they're really, you know, developing, getting, you know, hot and heavy in their relationship, he is drafted into the Crusades. Literally drafted into the Crusades by the Sheriff of Nottingham, played by Ben Mendelsohn.
Wait, he's playing a villain?
Yeah, believe it or not.
Wow!
Yeah, believe it or not. So poor Robin is separated from the love of his life and drafted into the Crusades, and it doesn't go great for him. He's a great warrior and all that stuff, but he doesn't like things that are being done to prisoners and stuff, including one. Moore, played by Jamie Foxx, whose son Robin tries to save unsuccessfully. But when he basically goes AWOL and comes back to England, he is followed, or at least found, by Jamie Foxx's character, and hopes to, disrupt the government by, stealing from the rich. We pretty much know the story by now. So train him to be an even better warrior. You know, when you see the trailer of this movie, you see like Jamie Foxx is training Robin Hood to shoot arrows and stuff. He already shoots arrows pretty well in the Crusades, I gotta say. So what exactly he's training him for in the movie is I don't really know, but you have to have the training montage and everything, and basically becomes Batman. He, takes on the role of Robin of Locksley, and, by day he's Bruce Wayne, and by night he's Robin Hood, and maintaining his anonymity while getting cozy with the Sheriff of Nottingham, yada, yada, yada. His his love of his life, Marion, since he was gone on the Crusades and was declared dead, actually, she has taken up with a man named Will, played by Jamie Dornan from 50 Shades of Grey. And he also has interest in disrupting the government and fighting for the people. He just has different ways of doing it. All right. So the last time we had a Robin Hood movie in theaters, we had the Ridley Scott movie. And I'm very sorry to remind people that movie exists, because I have pretty much forgotten that movie existed over the last 8 years, or at least tried to forget, because that was one of those, we're going to tell the real story of Robin Hood, Ridley was on that kick where it's like, here's the real story of Robin Hood, here's the real story of Moses, and all of them sucked. And so that film was so excruciating and boring to the core that when you have a movie like this that at least is lively at times and is shooting arrows, and arrows that can like go through concrete and stuff, you at least kind of like let down your guard a little bit and go like, okay, this is really silly, but at least it's not boring. But it eventually gets boring, because that's basically the only trick this movie has up its sleeve. It's really fast arrows, and you're kind of using the same approach that Guy Ritchie brought to Sherlock Holmes, and that's not a good sign either. This movie is remarkably silly at times, very dumb at times. By the time you get to the second half of this movie, and it's really trying to lay on the Robin Hood mythology, and not even laying it on very thick. It's all pretty very bland. But by the time you get to that point, you realize that this film has nothing going for it. It feels like the whole movie was just like a discarded pilot for one of those DC shows on the WB network, or whatever that network is called now, along with Arrow and Supergirl at one time. Well, Supergirl's on CBS, but the DC universe that's on that network. And by the end of it, it even sets itself up for a sequel, and a sequel that is never going to come, mind you. But it's so unnecessary. It's so dumb. I don't understand what they were thinking, and why, other than maybe Taron Egerton has some sort of, Kingsman made a lot of money overseas, and maybe they thought that they could plop him into a Robin Hood movie and they could make $300 million overseas. They spent $100 million on this movie. It didn't do particularly well at the box office here domestically, so we'll see where it goes from here. But this is just like a who greenlit this movie project.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought when I saw the trailer. I was like, who the hell is going to see it? Who wanted this movie and who's going to see it?
Yeah.
I mean, what are we talking about? And again, you know, as you mentioned, Eric, you know, I saw the first time I saw the trailer for it, that was the first thing that popped into my head. And then I said, I'm so tired of people aping the bad Guy Ritchie style. I mean, it's because it looked like Guy Ritchie's Robin Hood. That's exactly what it looked like. So, yeah. Well, I'm not surprised.
No, thanks.
All right, guys.
No, there's no need for anyone to see it.
All right, hang on, okay?
Yep.
All right, Eric Childress, Colin Suter, or Colin Suter is off. Jim Leskowski is in. And when we come back, we got more new movies to review on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here in downtown Chicago, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected with us on Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. And yeah, it's the movie reviews. My dad will tell a joke a little bit later on. We're going to talk about remakes, and we are, of course, covering the winter storm that is currently smacking the Chicagoland area around a little bit. So we'll cover that as it goes on. All right, let's get back to the movie reviews. Eric Childress and Jim Leskowski are with us. We're talking about the new movies, and let's get everybody back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Jim, let's talk about Ralph Breaks the Internet.
Okay, so this begins sometime after the events of the original, and quite an enjoyable Wreck-It Ralph. The titular game character voiced by John C. Reilly returns, along with his best friend, the glitching, candy-covered Princess Vanellope, voiced by Sarah Silverman. And they've sort of settled into a pleasant and comfortable routine of hanging out at all the same games, doing all the same things from sunrise to sunset, and pretty much just enjoying each other's company. For Ralph, it's kind of a monotony he gets to share with the best friend he's ever had. However, a wave of change comes in the form of the arcade's owner hooking up something called Wi-Fi to the arcade environment, and Vanellope's game, Sugar Rush, ends up being broken, threatening to permanently displace her and her fellow racers into the broader world of the arcade. So to restore Vanellope's home, she and Ralph sneak into the Wi-Fi, onto the big broadband world of the internet, hoping to find a replacement part for Sugar Rush via eBay to save the game and the universe they know and love. Within the world of the World Wide Web are a couple of interesting characters, including one named Shank, voiced by Gal Gadot, as a tough-as-nails driver from kind of a grittier online auto racing game called Slaughter Race. And it's a place that Vanellope sort of wholeheartedly embraces, so much so that Ralph begins to worry that he's going to essentially lose the only friend he's ever had out in cyberspace. And they also get caught up in the spreading of a virus that threatens to break the internet thanks to our protagonist. So the question remains, well, will they be able to maintain their connection in the midst of all the chaos that ensues as a result of all their good intentions? Well, this is a Disney property, but again, there are some surprises here. I would say the first Wreck-It Ralph was pretty good fun, and it was a nice nostalgia trip that I think both kids and parents enjoyed. And, you know, a sequel was kind of inevitable, but really for me, like, the best kids movies explore kind of these unexpected emotional spaces within the sort of expected brightly colored universe, and this one sort of juggles, you know, those tones quite nicely. I mean, for about the first act, I would say I was a little worried just because it was a little too silly for my own personal taste. Like, the setup itself was not the strongest point of the film, but there is a turning point where I really warmed up, and it's fairly early on once Ralph and Vanellope enter the other side. I think the biggest enjoyment for me comes when Ralph gets sucked into the world of viral videos, and there's one huge laugh in particular involving a goat viral video that kind of destroyed me, and there's, you know, a nice sequence that followed where people suddenly start sharing these really weird, surreal videos, and all of that kind of brought a smile to my face. And there's a great turn of events involving Vanellope's involvement with a certain group of princesses, and some nice sort of crossover cameos, let's say, from various franchises that are instantly recognizable for most people. And then late in the film, there's even a little bit of melancholy when Ralph reads comments about his videos. And ultimately, there's a really interesting message about codependence, of all things, and learning to let people in your life do the things they want to do. And I think that's a really great message for the younger crowd. So, I mean, in terms of laughs, I don't think it hits the highs that something like Teen Titans Go to the Movies did for me earlier this year, but I thought this was pleasant and enjoyable enough with some good laughs and an even better message. So I'm giving this one a slight recommendation. I thought it was pretty much on par with the original. So if you like the first one, I think you'll like this one just as much, if not more.
Okay. I'm a big fan of Wreck-It Ralph. I actually really, really, really like that movie. I didn't like this one as much as the first one, but there's great stuff in this movie, and some really, yeah, there's some really big laughs. There are a lot of, once they actually get into the internet, there are so many jokes that are all over the screen, you know, because it's overloaded with stuff because they're in the internet and there are like all these really funny little sight gags and jokes that are going on. And that sequence that you talked about where, Vanellope ends up in Disney, and because Disney owns every property in movie history, that's when all the crossover jokes start happening and characters showing up from all these fun properties. And again, it's kind of overwhelming. It's not quite as overwhelming as trying to watch Ready Player One the first time and get all the references in Ready Player One, but it's very similar to that. It's very, very similar to that in terms of what they're going for. I think the relationship between Ralph and Vanellope is lovely, and it was my favorite thing in the first movie. And I have to say, Sarah Silverman does great work in these movies. Like her voice.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, her voice performance in both of these movies is so, so good. And she's so wonderful and such a cute character, and you care about her. And you know, when the gaps come between, you know, Ralph and Vanellope, I was involved emotionally because I like these characters very much. I think it's a little long. It's almost 2 hours, and that's pretty long for an animated film. You can cut a good 10, 15 minutes out of this movie, make it a little bit tighter. Some of the other characters, I wanted to see more of Jane Lynch's character because, there's not a whole lot of her in that. And she was in the first one a lot, but she's kind of replaced by the character that Gal Gadot, you know, she kind of fits into the mold that Jane Lynch fit into in the first one. But no, I think the animation is really good, and I found the big climax thing with at one point there are a bunch of Ralphs, like thousands of Ralphs, and I found that to be really creepy, like just the way it looked and the way it was designed.
Yeah,
I thought it was creepy and exciting. So overall, I'm recommending this. I think there are statements being made about friendship here, about what you do as a friend, what is expected of you, what is expected that you expect of the other person. The statements about the internet are great. The whole comment section is great. And you know, how people get obsessed with the internet, the way it's visualized in the movie, I think is very clever. So I'm recommending. I didn't like it quite as much. I think my main complaint is that I think it's too long, but I didn't like it as much as the first one. But I'm still recommending this because I think both of these characters, Ralph and Vanellope, are just really, you know, really wonderful characters. So I liked it. And Eric, you didn't see it, right?
No, not yet. Okay. I'm looking forward to it though. Okay. I'm a big fan of the first one too.
Yeah, the first one's really, I think the first one was terrific. So. All right, Jim, tell me about, let's do Green Book. Tell us about Green Book.
Oh, sure. Yeah, this is a particular name that we all know and love, Peter Farrelly. This is his first foray into dramatic work, essentially, as a feature director going solo this time. He's known, obviously, as one half of the Farrelly brothers. And he creates this story inspired by a true friendship that you know, transcended race and class at a very difficult time in our nation's history. We follow a classically trained piano virtuoso named Dr. Don Shirley, played by recent Academy Award winner Mahershala Ali. And he's about to tour the American Midwest, Upper South, and Deep South. And he's accompanied by Tony Lip, played by Viggo Mortensen, who is a racist bouncer from an Italian-American neighborhood in the Bronx, happily married to Dolores, played by Linda Cardellini, and hired as a bodyguard and as a chauffeur to drive Don on what is, you know, anticipated to be a rather tumultuous road trip. They have to rely on what was then known as the Green Book to guide them to a few establishments that were considered safe at the time for African Americans. And Tony knows how to effectively protect as well as persuade people, which is why Don essentially picks them for the job. But it's clear that they obviously have a lot of differences to look past and a lot of stops to make and a lot of lessons to be gained from the experience and the journey they're about to embark on. What begins as a story about two people with very different lifestyles and expectations and seemingly no hope of getting along turns into an excursion and ultimately a friendship powered by genuine understanding, respect, and love. So, yeah, I mean, you know, when you see the trailer, as one would anticipate, you know, the hypocrisies of segregation are laid out throughout, and Don is, you know, celebrated as an artist and then at the same time denied service at hotels, restaurants and restrooms, and you know, these are, you know, are ultimately the brutal manifestations of white supremacy, which, you know, to some degree is still fortunately an issue to this day. There's even a small glimpse into you know, Don's homosexuality as well. So there's certainly a lot of layers that I personally didn't glean from the trailer initially, but I mean, when people use the word heartwarming, I think it is apt to apply it to a film like this, for sure. But at the same time, I also think it's a serviceable, entertaining crowd pleaser. I mean, I personally love a good road trip movie and a good buddy comedy. And this is an example of one that works quite well with, again, two great actors, sort of just creating very memorable, very likable characters. I mean, Viggo Mortensen sort of subverts his machismo that we, you know, obviously know him for and remember him from something like Eastern Promises. And he brings a lot of charm to this character. You know, he's not just ultimately just a brute who ends up caring about his traveling companion. And what can you say about Mahershala Ali? He is incredible and quite vulnerable here as someone who wants to be accepted, but of course, you know, be allowed to experience the bigger picture than what he's used to in the past. So I think the pleasure of films like this is that you know you're going to be charmed by everyone sort of, you know, being what you expect them to be, but there's also really good, authentic period recreations with great songs, great fashion. And I just think that ultimately the arcs of both of the leads here are very believable, enjoyable, and there's just a lot of positive energy. I mean, I will say it's a bit safe. It's a bit conventional in its depictions of prejudice. And, you know, it's certainly very familiar territory, but I can't deny just how warm and wonderful the performances are. It's the two leads in particular just have great, great chemistry. You know, it ends up being one of those movies that I can happily recommend to my family. And it's great for like a weekend matinee like I experienced. It's not a movie I'm going to be thinking about very deeply either, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think if you're a fan of these actors, you will have a great time watching them do great work. So I'm giving this one a recommendation for sure.
Okay, guys, hang on.
We'll take a break,
come back, and I'm going to tell you what I thought of Green Book. And that'll be coming up right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, and we're here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. Before the break, Jim told us about Green Book and what he thought about it. Let's welcome Eric and Jim back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you again.
Okay. I loved this movie. I loved it from beginning to end. It is, on, you know, just right off the top, one of the most entertaining movies, just simply one of the most entertaining movies I have seen all year. It is human. It is it's really funny. There are a lot of laughs in this movie, in Green Book. A lot of them generated by Viggo Mortensen, who is hilarious in the movie. And what did he gain, like 50 pounds for the role? He looks fantastic. And anytime he eats in the movie, it's hilarious, every single time. And he eats a lot in the film.
It was like Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11.
Yeah, but I mean, but like to levels where you go, my God. I mean, the pizza scene alone. So anyway, now it's not like we haven't explored this, as you mentioned, Jim. It's not like this kind of thing has not been explored before.
Right.
Deep South, 1962, the relationships between African Americans and whites, and what the differences were culturally and everything, and so this is not brand spanking new material, but the way that they go about it, I think is great. One, it's a terrific road movie. And I love, as you mentioned, Jim, I also love road movies. I think road movies are great, and this is a terrific road movie. And the relationship between these two guys is just stellar. Like, it is so, I mean, it's so beautifully written and so beautifully acted. That, you know, you see the arc that these two characters, both characters are different people at the end of the movie. And from they were from the start. And you see that from scene to scene to scene, and how they each grow and change independently and together. I'm telling you, it's one of my favorite movie relationships in years, these two guys. Like, to watch this relationship develop and to watch these two actors, my God, are they good in this movie? Like, they're two of the best performances of the year, and they work so well together, man. It's just, there are a lot of scenes of just, you know, two guys in a car. All right? Very simple. One guy driving, one guy in the back seat. And there are a lot of scenes of that, and every single one of them is compelling and fun and awesome. And you learn more and more about the characters as they drive through this time period. And again, I mean, you know, it goes through a lot of the same motions that you see with any movie that kind of deals with civil rights. But I just want to say this. My dad went nuts over this movie. Like, when it was over, he's like, that's one of the best movies I've ever seen in my life. And the crowd that we saw it with, we went Saturday afternoon, just this past Saturday, the crowd we saw it with, you could feel the energy in that room. People were laughing at the end. There was applause. You could just, you know, everybody in that room was having a great time watching that movie. And I just felt like it was, you know, and again, you mentioned the soundtrack, the music is great. The supporting performances are all good. Like, his family, Viggo Mortensen's family, hilarious. They're fantastic. Yeah. The guys he worked with at the Copa at the beginning of the movie, and then he goes into the diner for the hot dog eating contest. All of those characters, those periphery characters, are hysterical. Linda Cardellini is, you know, she doesn't have a ton to do, but she does it really well. There's a wonderful scene in the movie before Viggo Mortensen accepts the job when Ali's character calls up the house and wants to talk to her. And that's one of my, I thought was a scene that was really well acted by both of them. And there's a lot going on here. And the final line of the movie is hilarious and really beautiful at the same time. And it ends on that note. And everybody was walking on air at the end of the movie. My parents and I, we were like, oh my God. And so, I mean, I think this is great. It's one of the most enjoyable films I've seen all year, and I can't wait to see it again. I really can't wait to see it again. And, you know, if you're a fan of these two guys, and who isn't, to watch these two guys on screen throughout the running time of this movie is magic. It's absolute magic. So I loved Green Book. I thought it was great. So,
Eric? Yeah, it was one of those movies, too, where I wish I'd taken, like, my mom and my aunt to see it on Thanksgiving, because I think it's just like you're saying, it's the ultimate crowd pleaser.
Well,
that just gives you,
you know,
positive vibes.
That's how I saw it. My dad and my mom were sitting next to me when we saw it in a room that was full, and every single person in that room enjoyed that movie. You can tell everybody, like, not just enjoyed it, but really, really loved it. So I think it's great, and I just think everybody should see it. That's Green Book. Eric, hang on.
Okay.
All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll find out what Eric thought of it, what Jim thought of it, and what I thought of it. We're talking about Creed 2, which is in theaters now. And we'll do that after the news here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here until 5 a.m. We're going to be talking about movie remakes, good, bad, best. What are the ones that are better than the originals? We'll do that. We've had a spate of remakes recently. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. It's Monday morning. And we're keeping track of the winter storm that's going through the area as we speak, as we get closer and closer to morning drive. It is we're live, Allstate's Skyline Studios. All right, Eric, Creed 2.
Okay, well, this is the sequel to the surprisingly great and successful Creed, which continued initially the story of Rocky Balboa, but the illegitimate son of his rival and one time eventual best friend, Apollo Creed, played by Michael B. Jordan. After the results of that movie, we're a few years down the road, and as the movie opens, Adonis Creed becomes the heavyweight champion of the world. And obviously, this brings not just fame and obviously respect in his community, but also opportunities and a big challenge coming his way. Not the least of which is him proposing to his longtime girlfriend, played by Tessa Thompson. But across the way in Russia, the son of Ivan Drago from Rocky IV is on his radar and wants to challenge Adonis for the heavyweight championship of the world. The son of Ivan Drago, obviously coached by Ivan Drago himself, again played by Dolph Lundgren. And obviously, Rocky Balboa is still a major factor in Adonis Creed's life. So this movie is basically, taking us through the opportunity of Adonis Creed to potentially avenge his father's death at the hands of Ivan Drago as a new generation of the two men who fought in 1985 get to play out again some 33 years later. And this is a film that it's an incredibly high concept prospect what we have going with. No matter what your feelings about Rocky IV might be, I happen to really kind of shamelessly love that movie and all its ridiculousness. But it's a high concept prospect that could go a number of different ways, and the least of which would have been, sort of the way some people felt that the initial Rocky series went, that it was just a matter of coming up with a bigger, badder villain for Rocky to fight in the big, in the climax, and, kind of lost sight of, where we began in 1976 a bit. But this movie actually subverts those expectations. While it is giving us the grandiose fight that we're looking for, if we just want to see kind of a replay of Rocky IV, this is a movie that is, once again, like Creed, driven more by its characters than its plot. This is the kind of thing that I was rooting for while I was watching this movie, just kind of tiptoeing around each individual scene and watching to see exactly where they were going to take this storyline. Were they going to kind of go the route of, say, like Karate Kid Part 3, where, he's got to, Daniel's got to prove himself, but Miyagi doesn't want him to fight, and so he's going to separate himself from his mentor and all that kind of stuff. Thankfully, it doesn't quite go down that route. Is it just going to be a replay of Rocky IV? A little bit of that and a little bit of even Rocky III thrown in for good measure. But again, from scene to scene, the characters in this movie seem to be reacting out of human instinct rather than the plot, sort of jerking them in certain directions that we expect this film to go. Individual scenes in this movie I absolutely love. I love the proposal scene between Michael B. Jordan and Tessa Thompson.
Yeah,
I think that's beautifully handled. There's scenes, every time, Sylvester Stallone's been playing this character for 42 years. on and off.
Yeah.
And 42 years later, you can still tell how much he loves this character of Rocky Balboa, because he's not going to fully betray him in any way. And as we saw how great he was in Creed and the arc that he takes in that movie, you know, we see him again. We see, you know, a real honest guy. We see a guy that really does care for Adonis, that, you know, he's still kind of fighting off some demons from his own past. I literally got the chills when he walks into his restaurant and sees Ivan Drago sitting there.
You know what, dude? The entire audience went, oh!
Like, yeah. I swear to God, Nick, I didn't know. You know, I saw the movie with my mom, and I was watching. There were other people in the theater, and I didn't know where everyone was coming from in the theater. But I just sat there, and I just, this big goofy smile on my face, and was like, oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like the meeting you didn't know you wanted for the last 33 years. And I got to say, and, you know, this might be a low bar, but this is actually the best performance Dolph Lundgren's ever given.
Okay, Eric, he's terrific in the movie.
He really is.
It's a terrific performance.
He really is. And, you know, and you consider that, you know, how many, he's only got like 42 words, I think, in Rocky IV.
Right.
And Stallone has the great, or Dolph Lundgren tells a story in the Canon Films documentary about when he got the role of He-Man in Masters of the Universe. And Stallone came to the set and said, "You gave this guy lines?" You know? and now here he is, you know, again, you know, some, you know, 30 years later, and again, it's, you know, I think other than one kind of moment he has at the Wayne-in session with Adonis, I think other than that, you know, they don't turn him into just a cartoonish villain. Again, you see that there is actually, like I said, and I think they did a great job with the son too.
He
doesn't get a lot of dialogue in the movie, but it was showing that. What the Dragos have lost, what him and his father have lost over the years because of that loss in 1985, and there's shame involved. There's, you know, the son, you know, Drago Jr., you know, has this sort of this moral complex that he wants to fight and get something back for his father. So he's not, you know, he's a big strong guy, and we're rooting for Adonis and all, but he's not the worst person in the world. I think, you know, these shades of gray that the movie puts these characters through, I think is what sets it apart from other, you know, type sequels, you know, in this franchise. I thought this was a wonderful movie. You know, it was satisfying in both a nostalgic way, and also I think is a great follow-up to Creed. You know, it might not be as good as the first Creed movie, but it's a pretty damn fine sequel, if I do say so. And I, you know, if they do a Creed 3, I don't know where they'd go with it. But as long as it brings back these characters in the manner that they have in this movie, I'm there for it.
Yeah. Okay. Jim, what'd you think?
Well, if they're gonna have a Creed 3, maybe Clubber Lang. Maybe he had a son.
Yeah.
Who knows? But I'm with Eric. I thought this was pretty great, and you know, there's a lot of expectation walking into this movie for me because I'm with Eric. I don't care if it's a silly, dumb movie. I grew up with Rocky IV back when it came out. Stallone was my favorite movie star at the time when I was about 7 years old. The Rocky franchise, Rambo 2, and yes, even Cobra. I have an affinity for that era of Stallone and for all things Rocky IV, including the ridiculous soundtrack and the insane amount of montages, training montages, and, you know, there's like even a sequence in Rocky IV where he's just driving and thinking about all the moments from all the Rocky movies, which is, I rewatched Rocky IV, and I'm like, this movie's ridiculous, but I still love it, and so Creed 2, when I got goosebumps and chills, man, when Drago appears in that restaurant, for sure. And just the dynamic shared between, you know, father and son, as well as father figure and mentor with Rocky and Creed. I mean, that is just something I will respond to strongly no matter what. And, you know, it's built on a very simple formula. Not to sound like Randy from Scream, but I mean, the sports underdog formula works. It works for me every time. I'm not even the biggest sports guy, but I love sports movies. So, you know, when I say there are flaws with Creed 2, maybe a little bit, maybe a few things could have been fleshed out more. Maybe it could have been trimmed a little bit. You know, I've obviously Ryan Coogler shot, you know, the fighting scenes even better in the original Creed. But, of course, Michael B. Jordan is great, and Tessa Thompson is great. There's a wonderful training montage and a lot of emotional investment that has really paid off beautifully late in the film. I got choked up. But again, because I have so much invested in this franchise, I might be a little biased, but I really loved Creed 2, and I'm giving this a high recommendation. And the Rocky franchise rules.
Okay. let me just preface this by saying I do not have the same feelings about Rocky 4 that you guys have. Because I was older than you guys when I saw it, and I thought it sucked. But I have to say, I thought this movie was great. I love both of the Creed movies, and I was not looking forward to this because of the premise. I was like, oh no, that's really silly. But they pull it off. They pull it off completely. And a lot of it has to do with how good the script is and how they treat these characters in a three-dimensional way. The stuff between Tessa Thompson and Michael B. Jordan is wonderful. It's a really wonderful romance to watch develop, and what happens to them, and you know, there are complications to what happens between them. And I think Felice Rashad is terrific, and she's very funny in a couple of scenes. And the dynamic between that family and how Sylvester Stallone fits in with that dynamic is really beautifully done. Stallone is so good at Rocky, man. He's just, you know, I think he should have won the Oscar for Creed. I really do. And I think he got robbed. Yeah. I don't think he deserves an Oscar for this one because he's got a little bit less of an arc and a little bit less to do, but he's still terrific in it, and you still love the character. And the relationship that he has with, you know, Adonis is wonderful. The fights are good. They're not nearly as good as the way Coogler staged the fights in the original Creed, but they're great. They pay off emotionally, and everything builds up. And not only was it like when Dolph Lundgren first shows up, do you go, ooh, there's another appearance, and I don't want to give it away.
Yeah.
There's another appearance by a woman in this movie. When she walked in, we all went, oh. Because I kept thinking to myself, what was it like on the set? Now, Stallone doesn't have any scenes with her, but, you know, it didn't end nicely for them. I had no clue she was going to show up, and I hope people aren't giving it away. But when she walks into that room, I went, oh, come on now. Oh. But anyway, and the relationship between the father and son, I think, is beautifully done. And again, Dolph Lundgren rules in this movie. Like, he's really great in it. So, anyway, I'm with you guys, man. I'm giving it a rave, too. So that's three strong yeses for Creed 2. So, all right. Next week we have The Possession of Hannah Grace. I'm really looking forward to The Favorite. Cannot wait to see that. And then Burning is another one that comes out next week. So we got those for next week. Jim, thanks, buddy.
Cool. All right. Thanks. Happy to help.
Take care. Real quick, Eric, let's do a couple of quick thoughts on box office because we got to run here. Number one was Ralph Breaks the Internet. 5-day total, 84 million. 3-day, 55.6. Huge, right?
Yeah. This is people like to say the Frozen is because it went wide on Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
But it was actually in one theater for like a week before that. So I don't like to count it. So basically, Ralph Breaks the Internet is the biggest Thanksgiving opening of all time.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Creed 2, the one we were just talking about, 35.2 million for 3 days, 55.8 million. That's good also.
The biggest live action Thanksgiving opening of all time.
And it deservedly so.
Yeah, it's great.
Number 3, The Grinch, still doing really well. 30 million in 3 days. That's not bad.
No, it's doing fantastic business. Third weekend, it's actually like the third best third weekend for a November opening ever.
Wow. Then Fantastic Beasts, like we said earlier, not doing great here, but doing fine overseas.
Yeah, it's only $117 million here, so it's probably not going to hit $200 million in the U.S., which is well lower than any of the Harry Potter movies ever did. But it's already over $430 million worldwide.
Okay. And then, let's see, Bohemian Rhapsody, $152 million. Boy, that's a big movie.
This movie is on a Star is Born pace, Nick.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this movie is going to it's headed towards 190, has a shot at $200 million, has made $420 million worldwide.
It's amazing. And then let's just talk real quick. Let's talk about the failure of Robin Hood. $9.1 million, mm-hmm. $14.1 million for 5 days. That's pretty much a disaster, right?
It is a disaster. I mean, it's $100 million production, $14 million in the first 5 days. Like I said, unless they're thinking that they're going to get some international dollars out of this because of you know where Robin Hood stems from, I don't know what Lionsgate was thinking in doing this.
Yeah.
And they've been trying ever since Hunger Games and Twilight went down. They've been trying to come up with new franchises.
I see,
and
yeah.
You know, they have, for every John Wick, there's a Power Rangers.
Right.
You know, and now there's a Robin Hood.
Right. All right. All right, man. Well, thanks a lot for talking, and we'll be back next week to review all the new movies. Thanks, Eric.
Sounds good.
Okay, buddy, take care. There you go. All right, there it is. Those are the movies and the movie reviews and the box office, and we'll do it again next Monday. Take a break here on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios, 18 stories above downtown Chicago. And looking out the window, there's a building across the street from where I'm sitting right now, where they have big spotlights that are pointed up to the sky. And you can just see, I mean, the snow is melting when it hits the ground here down here in Chicago. But you can just see all the big wet snow like floating down. It's coming down really hard. Again, there's really nothing. I mean, I'm looking at the streets, and the streets are maybe have a little teeny bit of slush, but it's mostly just wet streets. But to see this this crazy snow coming down with these spotlights in the middle of the morning here, it's pretty crazy. So everybody be safe out there, and we'll keep you updated on what's happening weather-wise. So, hey, my next film club is a week from Tuesday, December 4th, and we're showing Bill Murray and Scrooged for the holiday. But we have a very special thing happening now. For those of you who know, we do my screenings at the AMC Rosemont 18, formerly the Movie Co. Theater in Rosemont. And right down the street from there is the Crown Point Plaza O'Hare, Chicago O'Hare Hotel, and that's where the Flashback Weekend convention happens every year. That's where we host Flashback Weekend. And they have a restaurant there now that just opened up earlier this year called Murray Brothers Caddyshack, and I went there. It's really cool. It's a lot of fun, and it's a really cool restaurant/bar. They have good food, and it's all, there's Bill Murray and Murray Brothers stuff all over the place in the restaurant. And it's kind of a tribute to the Murray Brothers and Bill Murray and those guys. Well, we reached out to the Murray Brothers Caddyshack, and we're going to show up there before the screening of Scrooged. And we're going to have a very Murray Christmas. So we're all going to be meeting at 6 p.m. at Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant located in the Crown Plaza, Chicago O'Hare in Rosemont, probably about it's a 2-minute drive from AMC Rosemont. So that'll be at 6 o'clock. And then we'll head over to the AMC Rosemont 18 for an 8 o'clock screening of the classic Scrooged with Bill Murray. The Murray Brothers Caddyshack is a really fun movie and golf-themed restaurant and bar. It showcases the Murray Brothers and their family. Now, here's the deal. For the Christmas party, we're very excited about this, to be working with the people over at Caddyshack. The Murray Brothers Caddyshack will offer a 15% discount to film club members on their food purchases. A 15% discount on the food. So go over to Murray Brothers Caddyshack at the Crown Plaza. Have some food, have a couple of drinks, and the food is 15% off. You have to show your film club ticket for Scrooged or proof that you have a ticket for Scrooged. Place your Christmas party reservations. You can call Caddyshack Rosemont and place your Christmas party reservations. Make sure you have your ticket for Scrooged. And show it, and it'll get you 15% off all your food. And if you want to make a reservation for call the Caddyshack restaurant, it's 847-443-3673. 847-443-3673. It starts at 6 o'clock. We're going to hang out there, have some food, celebrate everything Murray, check out the Caddyshack restaurant, and then we'll go over to the theater and watch Scrooged. And now, when you call up the Caddyshack restaurant in Rosemont at 847-443-3673. Make sure you tell them that you're with the Nick DiGilio Film Club. So when you make your reservation, they'll know that you're with the Nick DiGilio Film Club, which means you'll get that 15% discount. And then you can get your advance tickets for the movie of Scrooged, only $9.99 to get in. You can contact the Rosemont box office, the AMC Rosemont 18. So you can go to amctheaters.com. So go to amctheaters.com, get your tickets for Scrooge. Those are $10 a piece. Then make your reservations for the Very Murray Christmas Party that we're going to be having starting at 6 o'clock right down the street at the Caddyshack restaurant. And you can call the Caddyshack in Rosemont at 847-443-3673 and tell them you're with the Nick Giglio Film Club. Bring your ticket, and you will get 15% off. The food. And we're very happy about this. We reached out to them and they were very nice about it and very excited. 15% is a nice discount. So that's only for the Nick DiGiglio Film Club members, only for the people who are going to see Scrooge that night. So we're going to start out at 6 o'clock, have some great food, 15% off, and then go over and see Scrooged on the big screen remastered at the AMC Rosemont 18. So make your reservations now at amctheaters.com. And we'll see you December 4th, Tuesday, December 4th. Okay, let's take a break. We got the news coming up, and then we're going to talk about remakes. There have been a ton of remakes recently, and we're going to talk about the good ones, the bad ones, and which ones are your favorites. That's all coming up, but the news is up after this. Welcome back, everybody. Stay safe out there. If you don't have to go out, don't go out. And we'll continue to follow what's going on weather-wise here. But the snow is coming down, and so lots of stuff is happening here. So we'll keep you posted throughout the entire morning, and especially if you have to do any commuting. So just be safe. Take it slow. That's my suggestion to you is don't worry about getting to where you need to get if you got to get there quickly. Just take it slow. So, all right. We know there's been a lot of remakes lately, including Suspiria and A Star Is Born. And sometimes remakes are good. And in the case of those two, they are. They are actually good. Like, very good, in fact. And but there have been a ton of remakes out there, and I want to hear from you guys on which ones are your favorites or which ones are the worst that and movies that you don't want to see remade that ended up getting remade. 312-981-7200. So that's the phone number and text too. You can send us some texts about movie remakes. That's the topic we're getting into. 312-981-7200. You know, I was thinking of remakes that there have been a lot of remakes that made me mad, but I was not. I don't know why the first one that popped into my head was the remake of Assault on Precinct 13, with Ethan Hawke and was it who else was in that? Was it Lawrence Fishburne? I know Ethan Hawke was in it. That's one of my favorite early John Carpenter movies, and. And John Carpenter doesn't mind if his movies get remade because he gets money. That's the thing about Carpenter.
Yes, Lawrence Fishburne.
Lawrence Fishburne. And I thought it sucked, and it didn't need to be remade. And it's another one of these deals where it's like not enough. I didn't think enough people knew the original Assault on Precinct 13 to get a remake. But I think people went back to watch. And Assault on Precinct 13, like many John Carpenter movies, has gone on now to big cult status. Like, people have gone back and discovered that movie. It was only his second film, and it was before Halloween. So a lot of people didn't know what it was and went back and watched it, and it is a kick-ass movie. I mean, the original Assault on Precinct 13 is a great movie. And it also featured one of my favorite Carpenter scores, which he played live in concert a few years ago, and we were cheering. But yeah, the first one that popped into my head is a bad remake was Assault on Precinct 13. Dan, are there any remakes that you're like, don't?
You know, I think I've blocked them from my head.
Yeah.
Thankfully. One good one I did enjoy was Peter Jackson's King Kong.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
It's a great movie. And, you know, the scene involving the T-Rexes, I mean, that was one of the most thrilling times I've ever had in a movie theater. I mean,
yeah.
It's just stupendous, that sequence.
I love Peter Jackson's version. The 1976 version, even though Jeff Bridges has a very impressive beard
right.
In it, not so much. It's pretty bad. There's a couple of things in it that are kind of cool. you know, like the practical King Kong effects were good. Rick Baker did them, and Rick Baker was inside the gorilla suit as King Kong. And so there were certain things about it that you know, like when I was you know what, when that movie came out, I was 11, so I liked it. You know, when I saw it. But then as I grew older, I'm like, I mean, the original King Kong is by far the best. The 1933 version of King Kong is just the best. But the Peter Jackson version blew me away. I mean, I adored it. I absolutely adored it. And you know, those long, crazy, sort of endless adventure scenes on Skull Island were like with all these insane creatures and bugs and dinosaurs and all kinds of stuff. Like everything came to life, you know. And I just remember like and there's, I mean, those sequences go on forever. Like those are very, very long action scenes. And they top each other. Like, they keep getting crazier. Like, the stuff on Skull Island just keeps getting weirder and crazier. And it just doesn't seem to stop. And, you know, people complain because it was 3 hours long. It didn't bother me. I was invested in it emotionally. I remember there was an interview with Jack Black before the movie came out. And they're like, well, how do you feel about being in, you know, in a remake of such a, you know, I mean, one of the greatest movies ever made, one of the biggest classics of all time. And he's like, well, I would, you know, I think the movie's great and I'm very excited and proud of it. But I had an even harder job than some of the other people in the movie because I had to say the line, it was Beauty Killed the Beast, which is like one of the greatest ending lines in movie history. And he talked about how the day he had to shoot that scene where he was just freaking out. He was just like, I can't believe I'm going to have to say this line. So now another good remake where someone had to say some classic lines. Well, that's another thing that sometimes you have to do. Like if you go so far as to remake a classic movie that most people remember, you know, I mean, if you remake, like, Assault on Precinct 13 is a cult movie. Not a lot of people know it. Not a lot of people were as impassioned about it as I was, and it was angry about it. But a lot of people love True Grit. Like, they love True Grit. And John Wayne won an Oscar for it. So, when the Coens decided that they were going to do it, they called up Jeff Bridges, and Bridges is like, why are you remaking True Grit? Are you crazy? And they're like, no, we want to put it, we have a different sort of spin on it. And, theirs was based much more closely to the source material, so it's different. I think it's better. I think the Coen brothers movie is better than the original True Grit. But there's a famous line in the movie where John Wayne is going to, you know, shoot out. He's on a horse and he's going to shoot out with a guy and he screams, "Fill your hand, you son of a bitch." And it's like this, it's just a classic line reading that if you've watched Westerns or if you've seen True Grit or if you follow John Wayne's career, it's one of the most played and quoted lines that John Wayne has ever had. And that was another time Jeff Bridges was like, oh man, because he says the line in the movie. In the remake, but he says it differently because I, you know, everybody was waiting for that moment. Like fans of the original True Grit or people have seen the original True Grit were waiting for it. And of course, Jeff Bridges did a completely different take on it and it sounded great because he's Jeff Bridges. But yeah, that was another one. Those are big shoes to fill. And I mean, John Wayne fans are very passionate. John Wayne fans love John Wayne and they love John Wayne movies. And I remember when the Coens announced that they were going to remake True Grit, people were just sort of beside themselves. And I remember at one time, somebody announced, God, I can't remember what filmmaker was. This was years ago. Somebody announced that they were going to remake Citizen Kane, which is like, what? Are you insane? And then that fell through. But it was actually announced. I can't remember. It was a long time ago. But people just went nuts and said, you can't remake Citizen Kane, widely considered the greatest movie in the history of cinema. You can't do that. But and then it was scrapped. The whole thing was scrapped. Now another one just popped into my head that's horrible. Gus Van Sant's Psycho remake. Like the shot for shot, kind of shot for shot. What the? Have you ever seen that?
I've seen bits and pieces of it.
Oh, my God. I, you know, That's another one. Why? First of all, why would you remake Psycho? Because that's ridiculous. And second of all, why would you remake it shot for shot? Because it's in color? And then they added weird stuff to it. You know, like they added like visions that were in Norman Bates' head that aren't in the original movie. And yet all of the stuff that Hitchcock did, Van Zandt did copy. And that was, you know, that was when, you know, that was when Van Zandt was on a roll. Like he had made like four movies in a row that were critically acclaimed. And he was establishing himself as like, he was independent director at that point. This, I believe, was his first big Hollywood project because it came before Finding Forrester. Because Finding Forrester was like the big commercial. Punch the keys. What's the punch the keys, dog?
I'm the man now, dog.
Oh, yeah. I'm the man now, dog. That's right. And he says punch the keys at one point, too. But anyway, that was, like, I think his big sort of, like, commercial breakthrough. But Psycho came before it. And, but yeah, he was on a roll. I mean, he had done, like, I think the movie before his version of Psycho was To Die For, the Nicole Kidman movie, which was phenomenal. And he had done all of those really great independent films up and leading up into that. And then all of a sudden it's like, why are you remaking? What kind of direction are you going in with your career that you're going to remake and do a shot for shot remake of Psycho? So that might be the worst. That might actually take the cake as the worst idea for a remake and maybe the worst remake ever made. Now, some of them are great. We were just talking about some good ones, and I have a list here of some of the best remakes. And if you guys want to jump in, we're talking about your favorite remakes or maybe remakes that were unnecessary because, you know, we get remakes. There's like a remake released every month now, it seems, or like a reboot or a reimagining, you know, that kind of thing. So we want to hear from you for talk or text. It's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiCilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we are here until 5 a.m. And once again, we are definitely keeping an eye on what's going on with this winter storm that's blasting through the area, and we'll give you updates and on all kinds of stuff, including, you know, traffic and what's going to be happening further with this weather. And that's coming up with the stories that matter. With Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right, we're back and we're talking about remakes, movie remakes, maybe ones that you love or ones that you're not crazy about. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. The reason I'm bringing this up is because it seems to be, you know, like a remake released every couple of weeks now, and some of them end up being really good. Like I mentioned, the remake of Suspiria, which was, wow, was that a box office bomb? And that was one that I was actively not looking forward to, because I'm such a huge fan of the original 1977 Dario Argento movie. And when I first heard they were making it, I was so angry. And then eventually I started to warm up to the idea. I started reading some of the early reviews and seeing some clips and some trailers and reading some interviews and stuff. And I was like, okay, maybe I'll give it a chance. And then I ended up really loving it. So, anyway, 312-981-7200, you know, a couple of weeks ago when I talked with, Frankie Previtt from Frankie and the Knockouts, he's also the guy that, that composed, I've Had the Time of My Life from Dirty Dancing. Frankie mentioned the Dirty Dancing remake, which I got to tell you, Dan, I had completely forgotten that they remade it until he mentioned it. And then I remembered how awful it was. I was like, you know, that's not a good idea. And he didn't seem happy about it either, which he shouldn't have because it was a terrible movie. But I had blocked it from my memory. I completely had blocked it. So, all right, we're talking remakes. Here's Donald on WGN. Hi, Donald.
Hi. Yeah, what crossed my mind is I actually just saw the remake again recently, Lolita.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I actually...
The remake was very much more faithful to the spirit of the book and creepier and all that. Yeah, the other one was almost silly, the first one.
Yeah, I remember. I like the sequel, or I like the remake of Lolita. I'm trying to remember what year that was. That was like in the 90s, right?
Yeah, I think it was like something like 98.
Somewhere around there. Yeah. Okay. Good.
Yeah, it was a whole different morality approach to it too, absolutely. And it was realistic, you know. So.
Yeah. All right, Donald. Thank you, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Jeff in sunny San Diego. Oh boy. He brought up a good one here. This one rivals Psycho. Worst remake of all time is the PG-13 Point Break. You know, I did not see the remake of Point Break in the theater. And then it came on cable and I'm like, because they kept putting it off. I mean, Point Break's one of my favorite movies of all time. Boy, that's two Swayze movies we just talked about in a row here. Leave Swayze alone. Don't remake Roadhouse. If you remake Roadhouse, I'll be very angry. But anyway, so I kept putting it off, and I didn't see it. It came out. I remember it came out during Christmas. So I wasn't on the air at the time when it came out, and so it was one of those weeks like last week when we were off. We didn't review it, so I didn't bother to see it, and it wasn't in theaters long enough for me to go back out. And I also didn't want to spend, you know, like $10-$12 on it because I didn't want to contribute to the box office of the movie. So I ended up watching it on cable one day, and I was like, all right, I'll watch it. I was beside myself with how bad it was. I mean, just ridiculous. Just so, so stupid. 301 area code says, I Am Legend is more or less a remake of the Omega Man, which is a remake of The Last Man on Earth. None of them come near as good as being the 1950 or the source novel by Richard Matheson. You know, that's one of those deals where I like all three of them. That doesn't happen. Oh, you know what's another one where I like them all is the Invasion of the Body Snatchers movies. The original one that Don Siegel directed, the one from 78, Philip Kaufman directed with Donald Sutherland. The one from 93, Abel Ferrara directed, called Body Snatchers with Meg Tilly. And then Invasion with Daniel Craig and Nicole Kidman. I like all four of those. That's a very rare to like every version of a movie. I like all four of the Invasion of the Body Snatcher movies. Some people actually maintain that the 1978 version is the best. Have you seen any of those?
I have not.
The 1978 version is really scary. Really scary. Jeff Goldblum is in it. Leonard Nimoy. It's a really, really creepy movie. Like, really creepy. But I think I still have to go with the original as my favorite. But I like all three of them. The Body Snatchers, the Abel Ferrara one, was fantastic, too. And they all kind of took a different take on it. So, because the first one was essentially, you know, that was done during the Red Scare, where, you know, That was done during the Red Scare. The one from 78 was sort of a concentration on sort of new age medicine and new age thinking. The third one was based in the military. That took place on a military base, and the fourth one was aimed more at younger people, and took it to a different. And it wasn't as explicit as the other ones. So, yeah, but I like all four of the Invasion of the Body Snatcher movies. 312, the remake of Footloose was brutal. Oh, my God. I felt bad for Julianne Hough because I like her, but that was absolutely the worst. There's another one. Why are you going to remake Footloose? Why would you do that? And if I remember correctly, they didn't have the scene where the Kevin Bacon character blows off steam in the barn,
right?
Is jumping around and flipping and smoking a cigarette. That it's sort of like one of the most iconic scenes in the entire movie. And if I remember correctly, they didn't have that scene in the movie. If I also remember correctly, Colin liked it. Colin gave it a good review because he's like a huge fan of Footloose. I don't know why. Like, he loves the original Footloose. And I like the original Footloose. I think it's fun, but he like really, I think it was at the time it came out, how old he was and all that stuff. Like, these guys earlier talking about Rocky IV. Come on. But I can understand that because I'm guilty of liking terrible movies that I still have a soft spot in my heart because I saw them when I was a kid, you know? But So Colin really loves Footloose, and then like for some reason he gave the remake of Footloose a good review. I don't remember the specifics, but he gave it a good review. What the hell was wrong with him? Hey, have you seen 310 to Yuma?
I have not.
Russell Crowe, Christian Bale. That's a really good movie. That's a really... The original 310 to Yuma with Glenn Ford, the original one, it's good. You know, it's good. I think the remake... Boy, now we're I'm discovering that I think a lot of remakes are better than the original. I think the remake of 310 to Yuma is better. I do. And both Christian Bale and Russell Crowe are great in it. So, all right. Those are remakes that we're talking about. 312-981-7200. But yeah, let's just, not all of them are good because we just mentioned Point Break. So there you go. All right, let's take a break here for the news. When we come back, I want to hear from you at 312-981-7200 about remakes right here on WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are back. Here, live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It is a Monday morning, which means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're here till 5. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And all morning long, we will be following the weather and reporting on any updates concerning the weather and concerning the traffic and concerning all the other outages and things like that. You'll get all the details. Keep it tuned here. And if you have to go out, drive safely, drive slowly, and try to stay warm. So we'll keep an eye on what's happening in the weather. So that's right here on 720 WGN. All right, we've been talking about remakes of movies. And finding out that there are some good ones and some bad ones. And we wanted to ask you if you guys enjoy, which ones you guys enjoy. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. All right. Almost forgot the phone number, Dan. I've been off for a week. Come back. I don't know what I don't know what buttons to press. I don't know what the hell is. I've only been gone for a week. All right. Okay. We've got some texts coming in. If you guys want to call or text us, we're talking remakes of movies. Good ones, bad ones, some of your favorites. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. 301 area code says, I think that Denzel Washington is awesome, but the remake of The Bishop's Wife, The Preacher's Wife, should be forgotten. I agree. Dino says, Red Dawn. There's another Patrick Swayze. That is a terrible movie. Dan, have you seen the remake of Red Dawn?
I have not.
I'm trying to remember who's in it. I think one of the Hemsworths is in it.
I think you're right.
I think there's a Hemsworth in it. And I can't remember who the other kids are. But man, don't mess with Red Dawn. Why are you going to mess with Red Dawn? I totally forgot about it. Now I'm assuming Dino means that the Red Dawn remake was bad. That would be my guess. I would hope. Yeah. So, boy, I totally forgot about that one, too. That's another one I totally forgot about. I remember we were at a screening at the AMC Rosemont 18. We were at a screening at the Movico, and we came out, and they had just put the big cardboard, you know, poster, the cardboard stand, the lobby stand up in the lobby, and it wasn't there when we went into the theater, but we came out, it was there. And I know Eric was there, and a couple of other people were there. And when we walked past, it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't there before. So while we were, whatever movie we were seeing, which I don't remember what it was, whatever movie we were seeing in that time, you know, in that 2-hour time period, they put this lobby stand up for the remake of Red Dawn. And we walked out, and I think a couple of other people too, and we just kind of just stopped and looked at it and went, no! We were just like very angry. That was the first time because I had heard that they were going to remake it, but that was the first, and it was delayed too. That was a movie that was supposed to be released. I think that was on the shelf for like a year and a half or something. It was on the shelf for a long time. So, Red Dawn.
Dino checked back in. Yes, that was an example of a bad remake. And then a couple texters are letting us know there is a Roadhouse remake in the works, man. With Ronda Rousey as the Patrick Swayze role.
No, come on, man. Come on, man. No. Why? You know, Roadhouse has become, you know, a classic. But when that movie came out, it got destroyed and was considered like that, because that was his follow-up to Dirty Dancing. That was like Patrick Swayze made this sweet, you know, old-fashioned romantic movie. People, you know, the ladies loved him. It was like a PG-rated, very sweet, old-fashioned romance. And he comes out with this, with Roadhouse. But you know, does anybody know who's playing the Sam Elliott role? Who? Why would I don't? Is the Sam Elliott role going to be a woman too?
Does not seem to be any cast information on IMDb as of now.
God. All right. Mark from the 630 area code says, why remake The Day of the Jackal into a Bruce Willis, Richard Gere debacle, The Jackal? It took me years to see it after it came out on cable and was supremely disappointed. Yeah, that's another one of those. Don't do that. 847 area code says, Sabrina worked as a remake with Harrison Ford and Greg Kinnear. Yeah, no, that's actually not a bad, that's not a bad remake. You ever seen that one, Dan?
I've seen bits and pieces of it.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's not bad. The casting is really good. Who was it who played Sabrina in that? Was it Julia Armand?
Yes.
Did you know that Heat was a remake?
I did not know Heat was a remake.
Of a Michael Mann movie called L.A. Takedown. What the hell kind of title is that? That's fantastic. Now, there's a story. There's a story behind this. You know. Now, you know how whenever, you know, like, whenever I used to see or talk to Dave Kaplan, he would always bring up the fact that I didn't like The Negotiator, and The Negotiator was awesome.
Right.
Well, you know who does that to me for, because I don't like Heat. I know I'm in the minority on it. I don't like it. I think it's 9 hours too long, and Pacino's terrible in it. The first heist and shootout in the street, that's fantastic. The extended shootout in the streets is great. But I just like, by hour 10, I was like, is this movie going to end? And that scene between De Niro and Pacino, that everybody says is classic. No. But anyway, I don't like Heat. And so who brings it up all the time? Cochran.
That's right.
Here's what they say about the original movie, which is called L.A. I don't know why I find that title really amusing. It sounds like a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Steven Seagal in L.A. Takedown. Here's what they say. It's hard to believe that a different decision by a television network executive in the late 80s could have denied movie fans a chance to see Robert De Niro and Al Pacino face off on the big screen. When NBC wanted Miami Vice creator Michael Mann to develop another series for the network, he turned a script that he began working on in the late 70s. He turned it in, and he turned it into a script. And NBC passed on the L.A. set crime series, but aired the pilot as a fairly unimpressive television movie in 1989 with Scott Plank and Alex MacArthur in the lead roles. Who the hell are those guys? So they get De Niro and Pacino? Scott Plank and Alex MacArthur. I wonder if their diner scene was unbelievable. It's amazing what a little money and a lot more star power can do. Unhappy with the original outcome, Mann returned to the same material in 1995 for a theatrical remake, retitled as Heat, and the rest is cinema history. Though they both appeared in The Godfather Part II, Pacino and De Niro had never acted in a scene together until their restaurant meeting in Heat. Very true. Very true. The Godfather Part II, De Niro played his father. De Niro played Pacino's father, so of course they're not going to have any scenes together. So, I mean, in flashback, plays De Niro. De Niro plays his father in flashback. Plays Vito. Like, I'm explaining what The Godfather Part II is. Like, I need to explain to people what happens in The Godfather Part II. Everybody right now, everyone I was doing that was like, we know what The Godfather Part II is. People who are listening to this have probably seen The Godfather Part 2 75,000 times and know every line, and I'm explaining what happens in The Godfather Part 2. For those people who live in a cave, that's what happens in Godfather Part 2. L.A. Takedown. I wonder if that's out on video. We can see Scott Plank and Alex MacArthur in action. I would like to see that now. Now I'm really curious. I'm really curious to see it.
Well, a tradition holding Pat here, you know, you'll find it better than Heat, you know.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the opposite would be true, but.
Scott Plank and Alex MacArthur. Replaced by Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. You know, those guys have some bragging rights, though. Both of those actors can go, you know, I originated that role. Yeah. I told you the story about when my buddy Matt O'Neill, he played Barry in our version of The Vinyl Shop in High Fidelity.
Right.
And he auditioned for the movie because, you know, the Cusack and the guys came. So Matt went in and auditioned for Barry. And he didn't get it, obviously. But when, because the director wanted my friend Matt, and Cusack wanted Jack Black. And, of course, they obviously went with Jack Black for more, you know, for obviously for star power reasons and stuff. But anyway, Matt, they gave Matt a very small role in a High Fidelity movie. And he got to wear the jacket that he wore as Barry in our stage play as, you know, a nice little tribute, you know, for the minuscule amount of people who saw my play and then saw the movie. They would go, oh, that's the guy, he was Barry and he's got the jacket on. That was a nice little touch that they allowed him to wear that piece of wardrobe. But anyway, Matt told the story that when he walked on set, you know, he walked on set, he comes in, and Stephen Frears, who directed the movie, goes, oh, look, and he says hi to Matt. Then he says, oh, look, Jack. And he's Jack Black's like across the room, and he goes, it's the man who originated your role. So that's what these guys, Scott Plank and Alex MacArthur, they can do. We originated those roles in Heat. All right. Hey, more remakes on the way. If you want to jump in, please do. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And how you doing? It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we're talking about movie remakes. What are the good ones? What are the bad ones? What are the ones that are maybe better than the originals? 312-981-7200 for talk and text. We were just talking about how a lot of people are surprised that Heat was indeed a remake of a TV movie that Michael Mann directed called L.A. Takedown. And Mike is here to talk about that. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Nick. How you doing, man?
All right.
It was so funny. You know, I never thought I'd hear the movie L.A. Takedown mentioned ever again in my life. I recall when that made-for-TV movie was on in 89, and I watched it, and I had to say the only good thing about that whole movie was that 1987 Buick Grand National. Do you recall that?
No, I don't. I've not seen the movie, but I know what kind of car you're talking about.
It's on YouTube. You can get the full movie on YouTube.
Oh, okay.
And the undercover vehicle they used was a black 87 Grand National, and that was the star of the movie. That's the only reason I watched it, because I saw the preview, and I checked into it. The rest of the movie, blue chunk stuff, but I totally agree with you. And every movie you talked about, every remake, man, I agree with you 100%. Thank you.
Okay, take care, Mike. It blew chunks, Dan. That's a technical term. But it's cool. You can see it on YouTube. Yeah. All the Scott Plank and Alex MacArthur fans out there can rejoice because you can watch L.A. Takedown on YouTube. All right. 815 area code. Ghost in the Shell with Scarlett Johansson was a pretty toothless. That was terrible. And I like Scarlett Johansson. And I like the outfit she wore in that movie, but that was a terrible movie. The anime version was chock full of ideas, and all we got was, ScarJo in a nude bodysuit and a B-movie action. Yeah, that first part's all right, though. 808 area code, Fantastic Four. Well, yeah. Haven't we discussed that, Dan? Like, every version of it sucks?
Yep.
Yeah, we were talking about that with Stan Lee. Hey, by the way, I shouldn't give it away. I was just going to give something away that happens in Wreck-It Ralph. I don't want to give it away because I want people to see the movie because it's really good. And there's a bunch of jokes when they go into like the Disney part of the internet. And, you know, like we were talking about earlier, how many franchises that they now own. So you can imagine where what characters are coming from, what worlds, and they're all in there, very much like Ready Player One. And someone makes a cameo, and it's pretty cool. I mean, a lot of characters make cameos, but there's one, you know, there's a cameo in there. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. 847 area code, worst remake, Rollerball with Chris Klein and LL Cool J. Yeah, wow. Yeah. Mike says, which version of Destry do you prefer, Audie Murphy or Jimmy Stewart? I got to say Jimmy Stewart. Yeah, got to say Jimmy Stewart. 815 area code, Stallone in the Get Carter remake is underrated. Yeah, that wasn't a bad movie. The original is still better. But it wasn't bad. 847 area code, Miracle on 34th Street. That was John Hughes, if I'm not mistaken. I think John Hughes at least wrote it. I think he wrote the Miracle on 34th remake. 773 area code, it feels like they remake the Three Musketeers about every 10 years. And like photocopies of photocopies, it gets regressively worse. Yeah, was the last one when Sting and Bryan Adams and Rod Stewart as ass sang the song, the theme song from it? Because that was a while ago.
There
was a 3D one, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, there was a 3D one. It was terrible.
Wasn't there one with Mila Jovovich?
Mila Jovovich?
Yeah.
Maybe it might be the 3D one. That's such a great story. Alexandre Dumas is one of my favorite writers. You know what's a really good movie? A great version of his book? The Count of Monte Cristo from 2001-ish. Jim Caviezel is in it. That's a really, really good... You know, Kevin Reynolds directed that. That's why. Because he directed Waterworld. They should remake Waterworld, don't you think?
I think they should. Finally let the public have what they want.
That's,
you know?
Right. You know, people have been clamoring for a remake of Waterworld. Everybody except my ex-wife. All right. Here's Mike on WGN. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Nick. How you doing?
All right, man.
Several years ago, I think back in the 90s, back in the time when Edward James Olmos and Lorraine Bracco were married, they did Straight to Cable, a remake of Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo.
What?
Yeah, it was very loosely. Basically, played a cop who, I guess, accidentally shot an innocent bystander, and that was the whole setup to get him to relive this thing. It was bad.
It wasn't called Vertigo, was it?
No, it wasn't called Vertigo. No.
Because he didn't saw it.
But the same plot set up. Palmer did with Body Double.
Body Double was like an unapologetic combination of Rear Window and Vertigo. I mean,
here's a good one, though. I just rewatched this a couple of months ago. Assault on Precinct 13 as a remake of Rio Bravo, and I was surprised to see how many direct quotes there were in that movie.
You know, the times that I've interviewed John Carpenter, I actually did ask him flat out one time. I said, "How many times are you going to make Rio Bravo?"
Ghost of
Mars is Rio Bravo. Assault on Precinct 13 is Rio Bravo. Prince of Darkness, to a certain extent, The Thing is Rio Bravo. He's just obsessed with like that situation.
With Howard Hawks, man.
He loved him. Absolutely loves him. That's right. So I got to find that Vertigo thing. That sounds fantastic.
It's bad.
Yeah, okay. All right, Mike. Thanks, buddy.
You take care, buddy.
All right, man. See ya. A remake of Vertigo. What the hell is that? Wow. All right. All right. We got a break here for news, and we'll come back. We'll talk more remakes, and my dad's going to tell a joke, and then we'll wrap up the show. 312-981-7200. And again, the news is coming up next, and you will get the the latest, the very latest on the weather and what's going on the streets and what's going on the roads and what's happening in terms of outages and things like that. So that's the important stuff, and we'll get it to you right out of this.
Stand by. Apparently, the music player is also still on vacation.
It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Nothing.
I've never seen him do this before. That's interesting. But
okay, there we go. You know, I was just cruising around on online, and it's Nick DiGilio here, by the way. We're live in the Allstate Skyline. There's something. Something made a noise. Was that what you wanted to play?
Yeah, that I'm getting an email.
So, you know, we lost, over the past few days, we lost Nicholas Roeg, who was a tremendous cinematographer and a great filmmaker and a great director, who directed Performance, Don't Look Now, Insignificance. He died at 90. We lost Ricky Jay, the great, incredible magician, con artist, and tremendous actor who narrates Magnolia, who was also in Magnolia. He's in House of Games, or House of Cards, I should say. No, House of Games. House of Games, David Mamet, House of Games. And it was an amazing man, and he just died. He was 72 years old. And now I open up my social media. Bernardo Bertolucci passed away. Bernardo Bertolucci, who directed The Last Emperor, so many other films. He died of cancer. He was 77 years old, and he just died. They just posted it an hour ago. I did Last Tango in Paris. He did Sheltering Sky, a tremendous talent, a great director, and we just lost another one. So, okay, so death, you can stop now. You can just stop now. Yeah, please. Thank you. So anyway, Bernardo Bertolucci has passed away. So that's sad. All right. Hey, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're talking movie remakes and some of your favorites. And of course, we're discussing the genius of L.A. Takedown. you know what's another remake that I was not looking forward to that I ended up liking, and it was on the same level. This remake to me, when I heard that they were remaking it, it was on the same level as my reaction to the Suspiria remake, and that was Dawn of the Dead, the remake of Dawn of the Dead that Zack Snyder directed. Now, to be fair, he did make the zombies fast, which, you know, I'm not a fan of fast zombies. I'm a slow zombie guy. But it was actually very good. It was really good, and it was so much better than I expected it to be, and it's got a killer opening 10 minutes. Like the opening 10 minutes of the remake of Dawn of the Dead is really great. And you know who's hilarious in it? Ty Burrell from Modern Family. He's great in that movie. He's really funny in it. Ving Rhames is in that one. Yeah, no, that was good. It was surprisingly good. I remember I was so angry when I was like, you don't mess around. Don't be messing around with Dawn of the Dead. But they did a nice job with it. We were talking about John Carpenter before. John Carpenter has made one of the greatest remakes of all time, his remake of The Thing, which is, you know, an appropriate movie to watch now with this weather. If you're inside and you're in the cabin and you got the cabin fever, with the weather that's happening outside, I believe The Thing would be a very effective movie to watch now. I think if you're staying home from work, pop The Thing into the DVD player. It'll be, you know, as great as it is already, but, you know, with the snow blowing and the wind howling outside, man, it'll add a whole nother level of greatness to that movie. But, yeah, John Carpenter's The Thing way up there on the list of the best remakes of all time, without question. And, and I love the original Thing. I love it. But I actually prefer Carpenter's version. How about another one? David Cronenberg's The Fly, his remake of The Fly with Jeff Goldblum and Geena Davis. Another fantastic movie. Cape Fear. Oh, God, I hate that movie. I like the original. I hate the Scorsese. Oh, my God. The Scorsese remake. I hate that movie. It's the only Scorsese movie that I actively dislike. The only one. There are other Scorsese movies that maybe aren't great, you know, but at least are good. That's a really bad movie. Like, Scorsese actually made a really bad movie. How about this one? Brian De Palma's Scarface. One of the greatest. That is a fantastic remake. So, see. We got some texts coming in. If you want to jump in, call or text 312-981-7200. And we are talking about remakes. Peter in Decatur said, the big one coming out next year seems to be The Lion King. I've heard mixed reactions. While I understand it's a shot-for-shot, remake, many don't like the CGI. I guess it hopes to appeal to a younger audience with young voices. Mufasa is voiced again by James Earl Jones. Yeah, I know. I saw the trailer for it. I don't know. But they had such a big success with first The Jungle Book and then Beauty and the Beast, and now they've got Dumbo coming out, directed by Tim Burton, which actually looks pretty great. And Lion King, and they have another one, I think, lined up. But they had a lot of success. Like, and The Jungle Book was really good. Actually, Jungle Book is one of the first movies, if not the first movie I ever saw, like in a theater, that I at least remember seeing in a theater. It was either Jungle Book or it was The Love Bug, Herbie the Love Bug. It was either one of those two. And then I went straight to horror. Jungle Book, though, resonated with me. I loved The Jungle Book. And I remember when they announced that they were going to do the live-action version of it, I was like, you know, and Jon Favreau is directing. And he's, you know, he's a capable director. I mean, he directed the first Iron Man. And I think he's directing Lion King. He is directing Lion King, the live-action version of Lion King. But did you ever see the live-action version of Jungle Book? It's really good. Oh, you know what else? Pete's Dragon. Well, Pete's Dragon was half animated, the original one. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like the dragon was like was 2D animated wacky dragon. But that was really good too. I don't know. But they made a lot of money. I mean, that Beauty and the Beast, the live action version of Beauty and the Beast, made a ton of money. So clearly, as soon as that box office results started to go in, they're like Lion King. What the hell's the other one that I just mentioned?
Aladdin.
Oh yeah, Aladdin's another one. Yeah. Aladdin's another one. And that, you know, who's directing that?
Guy Ritchie.
What? It's going to be slow motion, sped up magic carpet? Is that what it's going to be? 708 area code. The recent Papillon remake. You know what? I never saw it. It was out for 2 minutes. 815 area code. The original Italian Job with Michael Caine was so good. The remake was pretty good. Yeah, the remake. You know what? The Mark Wahlberg version of the Italian Job's not bad. It's not bad. Megan, Freaky Friday and The Parent Trap are two Lindsay Lohan remakes, and they're both good. I really like Freaky Friday. I think Freaky Friday is great. It was right around that time when I was like, well, this Lohan she's something, because she's great in it. So is Jamie Lee Curtis. Jamie Lee Curtis is awesome in it. Yeah, and then it was like Freaky Friday, and then Confessions of a Teenage Shopaholic, or whatever the hell it was, and I liked her in that, and then Mean Girls, and I was like, well, that's it. She's going to be the greatest actress of all time and win 9 Oscars. That's what I predicted. After I saw Mean Girls, I loved her so much in Mean Girls, and I loved Mean Girls so much, and I thought she was so charming and so good and so talented, and then that never came to be. That is like, you know, it's whenever... You know, any kind of like personal addiction or issues happen to anybody, it's not good. It's bad, you know. But for some reason, the Lindsay Lohan collapse really was. I mean, I just was like, no, this is so tragic. Because if you go back and watch her early stuff, and even in Parent Trap, she's a kid. She's great in that movie. That just makes me sad. So anyway, all right. So there's some more remakes for you. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200.
It's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. With your music intro.
Ah! It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey! What'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
All right. Hey, Dan, I don't know if you've got Channel 9 on in there, but Marcus drew the short straw. They sent Marcus.
Oh, I do see that.
They sent Marcus outside to measure the snow. They usually send him to fun stuff like roller coasters, and he's out in the snow with a tape measure. Marcus do something wrong over the weekend? What happened? Oh, boy. He's doing his regular, you know, his regular report, which he does at 4:48 every morning.
Yeah, shock value.
But he's outside. They got him outside. All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and Steve Grzanich is coming up with the opening bell, and the great Steve Cochran coming up with Morning Drive, and throughout the morning, constant updates on what's happening with this weather. And what's happening on the roads and all that stuff that you need to know. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right, you heard the theme. You know what that means. We had a week off, so my dad is back. Every Monday morning, my dad calls in and tells a joke, and we'll do that right now. Hey, Dad.
Hey, Nick.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
All right, how's Ma?
Real good.
Good. Now, how's it? Well, you guys how much snow do you guys have over there?
Not a whole lot.
Yeah, you know what?
About maybe 2 inches, maybe three.
Yeah. That's when it turned out. I mean, the city's not getting as hit as bad. I mean, but there are places like Rockford. They got over a foot.
Wow,
it's crazy.
All right. Not bad here.
Okay, not very bad. All right, good. I just want to
know. This is joke number 233.
Joke number 233. Everybody, for those of you who are keeping track. All right, let's hear it.
Okay, a wife, you ready?
Yeah.
It said a wife got so mad at her husband, she packed his bag and told me, get it the hell out. As he walked out the door, she yelled, and I hope you die a long, slow, and very painful death. He turned around and said, so you want me to stay?
All right. Oh, man. I just... How long have you and Mom been married? 56 years. 56 years. Okay.
56 years of marital bliss.
Yeah. All right. That's cool. That's why you can. That's why you can. You've been married for 56 years. That's why you can tell jokes like that. Exactly.
You're right.
Hey, by the way, I don't know, Dad. Did you hear our earlier? I know you probably were sleeping. Did you hear the reviews that we did for Green Book?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. Well, everybody loved it.
That was a great movie. I think it's my favorite this year.
Yeah, I know. I know you were. It was such a good movie, though. I mean,
yeah.
So anyway, I didn't know whether you heard it, but we all gave it a rave. So,
yeah. All right. Good.
Okay, man. I'll see you later.
All right, Nick. Okay. Talk to you later.
There you go. Stay dry, my friend. All right. You want me to stay? All right.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
That's right. He'll do it again next week. I don't know if it'll be offensive to wives or not, but that's not offensive, but it's just funny. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. We've been talking about remakes of movies. You know what's another one that you kind of forget it's a remake? Is Little Shop of Horrors, the musical version of Little Shop of Horrors, because it's, you know, it's the same concept and the same idea, but it's so different than the one that Roger Corman made, like, in two nights. Like, he shot in, like, two nights. But that's a great movie, Little Shop of Horrors. The musical version is great. I love that one. The Ring is a remake, the American version of The Ring. There's a bunch of those. Remember, like, in the mid-2000s, when every horror movie came out was a PG-13 rated Japanese remake?
Right.
A remake of a Japanese horror film? Let's see. Wait, Scent of a Woman is a remake? I didn't know that. according to this list, Scent of a Woman is a remake. I didn't know that. Oh, here's one. Insomnia. Fantastic. Christopher Nolan remake with Robin Williams and Al Pacino. The original's really good, too. The original's really, really good as well. Let's see. Great Gatsby? Terrible. The Longest Yard. I just showed the original Longest Yard a few weeks ago at my film club, and we talked about how bad the Adam Sandler remake is. Let Me In? One of the Chloe Grace Moretz's unnecessary horror remakes that she starred in. Now, I liked, she's in Suspiria, and before Suspiria came out and I actually saw it, I was going to lump it in with the other ones, but she did now three, she's done four horror remakes, but Suspiria is good, but she was in Let Me In, which is a remake of Let the Right One In, and it stunk. She was in the Amityville Horror, which was remade with Ryan Reynolds back in the early 2000s, 2005, I think. And that wasn't good. But most disappointingly was the remake that she was in of Carrie, the Carrie remake. Just completely unnecessary. And then I thought that streak will continue with Suspiria, but Suspiria turned out to be good. But she does have a tendency to star in horror remakes. I never, it's four horror remakes that Chloe Grace Moretz was in. Let's see, here's Sean on WGN. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Nick, how you doing?
All right, what's up?
All right, not much, just working.
All right.
Yeah, but I was just calling to find out, have you spoke about Ocean's 11?
Oh, no, we haven't. We haven't.
Okay.
And that's another that's another one I think that's better than the original, even though I love the Rat Pack, but I like the newer version better.
Right. Well, it's just, you know, it's the premise is the same, but
right.
the stars that were involved in each of the series, I think, were pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And they were big. They were like some of the biggest stars of that time period. Both of them, both of the movies. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. All right, absolutely. Sean. Thanks, buddy.
All right.
Take care.
Yeah, thank you.
And then that spawned they did Ocean's 12, Ocean's 13, and then like the offshoot was Ocean's 8, right? That's right.
Yeah.
All right. How about War of the Worlds? Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds. That's remake. That's a really scary movie. Tom Cruise. That's a really scary movie. Heaven Can Wait, which is a remake of Here Comes Mr. Jordan. Warren Beatty, Julie Christie, the great Jack Warden. Let's see what else we got here. The Wolfman. With Benicio del Toro. That didn't make any money. That was when they were going to, you know, they were trying to, at one point they were going to reboot. Remember they were going to do the Universal Horror Universe? And then The Mummy came out, speaking of Tom Cruise, then The Mummy came out, and that plan was killed. Like, yeah, we're not going to bring back the, because that movie lost a lot of money. And it was bad, too. And I like Tom Cruise, but The Mummy was bad. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the remake of Willy Wonka in the Chocolate Factory. And again, I'm way in the minority on this, but I mean, people think I'm nuts, but I like the Johnny Depp, Tim Burton movie better. I know. There are people screaming at their radios right now. I get a lot of guff for that, but I actually think, you know, it's closer to the book. It's closer to the Roald Dahl book. Much closer, and it doesn't have the terrible songs, because there are some terrible songs in Willy Wonka. And listen, I grew up watching Willy Wonka, and I love Willy Wonka. I do. And in Gene Wilder, you know, I mean, come on. Gene Wilder rules in it. He's fantastic. But the source material, Tim Burton was much closer to the source material than the original was. And again, it didn't have the terrible songs. So. Yeah, I remember when I reviewed the remake on the air. Oh my god, the feedback was not pleasant. Let me just say that. And of course, let's close with the Departed. The Departed was a remake of an Asian action film called Infernal Affairs, and it's very similar, but The Departed's a remake. A lot of people don't remember that. So that's the movie that Scorsese won the Academy Award for. And that's the they gave it to him for the wrong movie. I love The Departed. I think it's great. But he should by the time he won the Oscar for The Departed, he should have already won 7 of them. So, all right. All right, we're going to break here. We got the news coming up next, and the opening bell is coming up. And then tomorrow, we'll be back for 2 for Tuesday. And I believe the weather will be much more pleasant. It'll be cold, but we won't have all this nonsense falling out of the sky. And Jim Ryan is going to be here, our buddy Jim Ryan, and we're going to talk all things music and concerts and stuff and interviews that he's done. We always have a lot of fun with Jim. So Jim Ryan will be in to talk music tomorrow, and we'll take a break because the news is up right after this.